to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday in Detroit. Bad loss for the University of Michigan, Indiana. But
I didn't know. Yeah. I've been a busy girl this
72-71.
Oh, that's tragic.
You know, I was in here this afternoon, and one of our jocks was watching it, and like it was like 10-7, and I said, you know, I never watched the last 10 minutes.
Right.
Sometimes I should. Yeah,
there's a lot of sports enthusiasm.
There is. I mean, you know, you miss a lot of good plays if you do that. Hey, Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan with you. This is the Riff's phone-in talk show, so we would like to hear your opinion, as Mr. Announcer said at the beginning. You can call us at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you would like to email us, that's easy as well. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall, and join us. A lot of good stuff on there. Jolene posts, Debbie posts from Northampton, Massachusetts.
She posts a little more than me since I go 7 days a week hard, being in culinary school. I don't mention that a lot, but I am in culinary school in 8 weeks. I'm going to be a professional chef and a professional DJ.
Yeah, what's that? Hey, good looking. What you got cooking?
That's all I do is
how about cooking something up with me?
It's politics and food.
My voice isn't getting better, is it?
Your wife said that to me.
Not to sing and not, and you say don't do math on the air.
But you don't listen to either of
us. Now, here's a little housekeeping from another Peter who wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, Peter, I just got through listening to last week's podcast and they cut the interview off. I was hoping to hear the one with the Kurt Vonnegut biographer, bad podcast maker. I love your interviews. I love to do them. It was me.
It was your problem?
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing.
I did it. I screwed up.
I would think if they went to whiterosesociety.org, they could still catch those interviews.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, whiterosesociety.org. Look for Peter. I believe Ben Birch, who takes care of that, has...
Tapes it off what century is this?
He records it.
He records
it, and all of our shows, I mean, Peter, I cringe to go back to like 13 years ago when we were syndicated and listened to some of those shows.
Yeah.
I don't think I could do it to myself. Although, it might be a fun game, or drinking game or something.
Really?
Every time I say
it. I like it. I like it. Hey, I hope we didn't let anyone down. I remember last week we announced that Dan Barker, the co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, an atheist group, was debating Reverend Joe Boot, the founder of the Ezra Institute for Contemporary Christianity, on the question, is there life after death at the University of Windsor on Thursday? And Jolene and I both enthusiastically said, yeah, we're going to be there. Come on, we're going to listen to it. And both of us were no-shows. So I don't know that anybody came because they thought we were going to be there. But I forgot completely that I had a very, very important block club meeting.
Yeah.
You had some
things,
personal things to take care
of.
Yeah,
everything's cool.
So we couldn't go. Did anybody make it there? Anybody?
I hate missing it because I really wanted to meet Dan Barker in person. I've been talking about him for so long.
Well, you have another opportunity.
Oh, is he still in town?
He is going to be tomorrow night. We'll talk at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor at 6 p.m. in the East Room at the Pierpont Commons on North Campus. And if you would like to do that, you can probably go to the Freedom From Religion Foundation website. It's ffrf.org, the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And he'll be talking his atheist thing, which will probably be, he's very interesting.
He is.
And we've interviewed him a number of times. But I really wanted to see him debate a modern Christian, a dynamic Christian,
This is the modern day. There may be some type of a YouTube situation that we can still watch it.
Well, yeah.
I'm coming up with all kinds of good ideas.
Well,
I'm glad I took a nap before the show.
maybe no one went because the phones aren't ringing about that at 313-298-WRIF. But Dan Barker will be in Ann Arbor tomorrow. And let's see. I just received the magazine, the newspaper, really, the tabloid from the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Tabloid? That sounds bad. Tabloids like the Star and the Inquirer.
What do you call like the Metro Times or Real Detroit?
Well, that's an entertainment. I mean,
what's
weekly?
The form? I mean, there's a magazine.
Yeah.
They call a full sheet or a broadsheet, which is like the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press.
Sure.
And then there's a tabloid. I mean, it's a printer's term.
I know,
but I know what you're saying.
But now you can't, with the paparazzi, it's a negative term.
Okay. Because, all right, in this tabloid, you do not find the alien.
That's right. The alien didn't give birth to
whoever.
You know.
But anyway, there was a number of letters in it this time that they said as soon as this arrives, people read it cover to cover. And I have to say, I do the same thing. It's called Free Thought Today. But here were a couple of items I thought were interesting. The American Bible Society, so we're coming from the Christian end of it here, although this is quoted in an atheist paper, partnered with the Barner Group and has identified America's most Bible-minded cities based on, quote, highest combined levels of regular Bible reading and belief in the Bible's accuracy. The most Bible-minded city was Knoxville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And tied for the least Bible-minded were Providence, Rhode Island, which I actually thought was a little, you know, no one ever hears. You ever hear anything about Rhode Island?
Not really.
No, it's not a, yeah. But it's, I think it's heavily Catholic, Italian Catholic.
Okay.
But still. And also New Bedford, Mass. And others in the top 10 most, what do they call it? The most Bible-minded were Charleston, West Virginia. Huntsville, Alabama,
mm-hmm.
Lynchburg, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
Charlotte, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
Springfield, Missouri,
oh, yeah.
Jackson, Mississippi,
amen.
Birmingham, Alabama, Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Shreveport, Louisiana.
Well, this is just so shocking.
Now, here, this is shocking. Others in the top 10 least biblical-minded category in descending order, which... What would that mean? Descending, I mean, going down. So this would be, so the top one would be Buffalo, New York.
That, and this is what?
The least.
Least read.
The least Bible-minded.
Okay, so yeah. Buffalo.
Yeah.
Okay.
Buffalo, where are we here? Cedar Rapids, Iowa?
Well, you know, I've been to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'm from Iowa.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's kind of a college-ish town.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe, you know.
Phoenix, Arizona, San Francisco and Boston, you could get that.
Mm-hmm.
Hartford, New Haven, Connecticut, Portland, Maine, Burlington, Vermont, the People's Republic of Burlington, as it's called. Yeah. And Albany, New York.
I'm surprised that more kind of progressive cities like Portland, Oregon or Austin, Texas.
Or Seattle.
Or Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Ann Arbor. Maybe
you know?
This doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. I don't know where they got their information. I don't know how you gauge the accuracy of who really is reading the Bible or not reading the Bible.
Well,
you know?
In the hometown of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Madison, Wisconsin, they were number 56. So there was 55 others that were less Bible-minded, and they put, we was robbed.
You know, I would put Madison way up there, too.
You know what?
They're pretty hip, too.
I mean, I thought that was...
not that you can't be hip and religious. I mean, you know, we're not bashing away, are we?
Yes. I thought, you know, maybe that doesn't make a bit of sense. All right. Here.
I don't know.
Okay. Here.
It made sense in... A strange way, I guess.
Okay, so we don't really know anything about that group. Any thoughts on this? Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF.
Now, my question, though, is to present a question to the audience is, do you read the Bible? Do you read the Bible? Do you read it on a regular basis? Have you ever read the Bible? Because it's, you know, they say that religion is dwindling.
Pay no attention to what this woman just said.
No, I'm serious. I'm curious.
We do not want to know whether you read the Bible or not.
I want to know because I don't know. Well, okay, I can't say I don't know. Hey,
okay.
I personally know only a couple of people who actually read the Bible, and they say that you know the younger folks, like WRIF listeners, for
you know,
example,
you're gonna
the demo,
flood
the younger,
you're, yeah.
that's fine.
How about just a yes?
The younger demo, the younger demo of people, I think, are reading it less and less and going to church less and less.
Well, that is true. But so here,
that's why I'm curious.
This is pretty interesting news. This is a little, so I'm wondering about that whole little study there, but I thought I was reading this one, but that other one was interesting too. Gallup, the Gallup polling firm, which is kind of conservative, they polled a third of a million adults about religion throughout all of 2012. About 40% of the respondents said they're, quote, very religious. Religion is an important part of their daily lives, and they attend services every week or almost every week. Now, we have talked about this before. In polls, people regularly, let's say, misreport the two main things, which are religion.
Sex and religion.
Sex and religion.
Yeah, well, they're not going to, they don't want to be heathens here.
Yeah, well, and a lot of times, so you get, when you, in, and they've correlated this. Do you go to church? Yes, I go every Sunday. And more than that, oh yeah, I go on Wednesdays too. How many times a week do you have sex? Like six. You know, that's not that. But so that's all they're doing is going to church and having sex. But.
Or neither.
God
at
bless
all.
Them. Yeah. But get this, another 31% are non-religious.
Yes, yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
And I would think too that that people see people are concerned about the even the pollster, because it used to be if you said you were non-religious, atheist, thanks to George W. Bush bringing Christianity to the fore and the right wing brand of Christianity typified by the teabaggers, it's really allowed atheism and agnosticism and non-religiosity to come out of the closet, so to
speak. Yeah, and not be such a devilish thing.
So I, based on nothing, so well, you're wondering why am I bothered to say it, but I would say that probably less people are very religious than they report, and more people are non-religious than they report.
What about the sex part? What do you think about that?
The remaining 29% are moderately religious. Religion is important, but they do not attend services regularly. The most religious states were Mississippi.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Tied for second place, Alabama and Utah.
Oh, well, yeah. There's that.
Louisiana,
Mormon thing.
Arkansas, South Carolina, Tennessee, North Carolina, Georgia, Oklahoma, Texas, and South Dakota.
The South. It's the South.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the least religious states were, first and foremost, Maine, then New Hampshire, then Vermont, then Massachusetts, then Rhode Island, then Connecticut, then Alaska,
wow,
then Washington State, then Oregon, then Nevada, and Hawaii.
It's like east-west, you know, east coast, west coast kind of thing. Well, I had a couple of religious, religion-related experiences this weekend, as a matter of fact. This is terrible. You know the people who go out and deliver the little watchtower?
Yeah, sure.
What is that religion? Is it
Jehovah Witness?
Jehovah Witness, thank you. Yeah. Why does it always? Anyway, they like to come to my door. Okay?
They like to come to everybody's door. There's never been a person on the planet who haven't, at least in the U.S., that hasn't been visited by.
Yeah, them. Actually, I have two experiences with this. This one is yesterday, and the knock comes on the door, and if anyone knows me, knows that they, I don't really use my front door. Know me, they go to my side door.
Same with me.
You know, right? Yeah, exactly, Peter. And so, you know, I kind of peek out, and there's this poor little girl, and she sees me, and I still didn't open the door. I just walked back and kept doing my, so I felt a little guilty about that.
Well, they're the nicest and most polite people in the world.
They're wonderful.
Yeah.
And then I was at our local grocery store down the street here, and it was the weirdest thing because I'm walking in and the sliding glass door is open and out comes this lovely woman and she says, excuse me, did you get one of these yet? And I'm thinking, yeah, I just got out of my car and it was the watchtower. And you know, I used to really combat these people. I really used to just be like, come on, you know, not in a mean, horrible way, but I would let them know what's up. Don't ever come back here kind of thing. I just go, no, but thank you and have a nice day. And she was so sweet. So then on the way to Autorama today, I did a live broadcast for one of our sister stations. I get cut off by this car. And you know where I'm going with this, Peter, right?
No.
I mean, this person was brutal. And, it was very stressful. And it has a big, giant, giant cross on the back of it. And I thought, you know what? Your Lord Jesus Christ wouldn't be very proud of you right now.
Maybe you just made a mistake.
Who made a mistake?
A traffic mistake.
There was hardly any cars on the road.
Okay.
It was a pure rudeness. Be a little more Christian. You know who you are.
313-298-WRIF if you have any reaction to that. This was, I thought, pretty interesting. with all of this stuff about guns, and the Colorado Senate has actually passed a bill that would have, they call strict new measures on gun control. Actually, what they did is they limited ammunition magazine capacity and are calling for universal background checks. So, I mean, not
gonna take a gun away. And that's for new purchases. That doesn't have anything to do with what's already owned.
But, so when we hear that guns are flying off the shelves, that, that there's been this incredible uptick of background checks so that we know people are buying, that ammunition is flying off the shelves, that they can't keep enough of it in stock, that the NRA, the major lobbyists for the gun manufacturers, essentially the whores for them, may I say that?
The hose.
The hose for them, So this is a country armed to the teeth. More and more people are arming themselves. That's what I would have thought. But it turns out that there's a four-decade, a 40-year decline in homes that have guns. The share of American households, according to this article in the New York Times, with guns has declined over the past four decades. A national survey shows with some of the most surprising drops in the South and the Western Mountain states, where guns are deeply embedded in the culture. The gun ownership rate has fallen across a broad spectrum of households since the early 1970s, according to this public opinion survey. Over 2 years, the rate has dropped in cities large and small, in suburbs and rural areas, and in all the regions of the country. It has fallen among households with children and among those without. It has declined for households that say they are happy and for those that are not. It is down among churchgoers and those who never sit in pews. The household gun ownership rate has fallen from an average of 50% in the 70s down to below 35% last year.
I was trying to wrap my brain around this and why that would be. I think what it is maybe fewer households have them, but the people who really want their guns have a whole bunch of them.
Well, that's what it is. The findings contrast with the impression left by a flurry of news reports about people rushing to buy guns and clearing shop shelves of assault rifles after the massacre last year at an elementary school in Newtown, Connecticut. The director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research says these are all claims that gun ownership is going through the roof, but I suspect the increase in gun sales has been limited mostly to current gun owners. The most reputable surveys show a decline over time in the share of households with guns. That decline, which has been studied by researchers for years, a broad shift away from gun ownership is underway in a growing number of American homes. It also raises the questions about the future, future politics of gun controls. The survey does not ask about the legality of guns in the home, so there could be a lot more because there is a whole lot of people with illegal guns that use them illegally, right? I mean, one of the things that the argument that these pro-gun manufacturing pro-gun groups make. I mean, come on, they are just shills for the gun manufacturers, and that's where they get their money. But
let's just be real.
Most of those people that have gone through the legal process, although still their homes are less safe, they have a higher rate of suicide, more, you know, all of that. They're not gonna have illegal guns, and they're not gonna use them for stick ups or
gang banging
or stuff like that. Yeah. Illegal guns are a factor. Is that all right?
I mean, it's all right, but it's the wrong term.
No. You're thinking of a different thing.
Gang activity.
Gang banging.
Carry on.
You got a different. It's taken on a different.
We need to talk.
You're beautiful when you blush. Tell them, folks. Google it. You Google it right now. Okay. That's like teabagging, right?
Yes.
It has different meanings.
Oh, my gosh.
Geographic patterns were some of the most surprising in the survey. Gun ownership is in both the South and the Mountain region, are like states like Montana, New Mexico, and Wyoming, dropped to less than 40% of households this decade, down from 65%. The Northeast, where the household ownership was the least, it was at 22% this decade. Now, the household gun ownership among Americans under the age of 30 fell to 23%. So just anybody is worried that we're not going to have enough guns around. I thought there was a figure in here. They think there may be as many as 320 million guns around. So
yikes.
They're not going to be confiscated. Oh, yeah, here. Estimates in the number of guns in the United States range from a low of 280 million to 320 million. think about that as an industry and what that provides.
What that means, I wonder how that relates to, like, sports, you know, profits from sports-related activities.
Yeah, huge industry.
Huge.
So, you know, there's hunting, target shooting, home defense, what have you. But the work of groups like the Gun Owners of America and the National Rifle Association that increase the level of paranoia in order to engender sales is really quite repellent. South Dakota became the first state to enact a law explicitly authorizing school employees to carry guns on the job. This will probably be very workable until the first teacher goes berserk and shoots his class and shoots himself, or the kids steal his gun, or the gun tumbles out of his pocket.
The possibilities are endless. And good old South Dakota, boy, they just, you know, the one thing I can say about that state, consistent.
Right.
God, I have a friend from high school who lives there. I don't know how you do it, girl.
Yeah, right. So, but as I always tell people, and we tell people, you tell people, I tell people, there is not going to hardly, I doubt if there'll be any gun legislation that goes through. And one of the things is that normally, although that hasn't been completely the rule, usually on a talk show, the people that are like whacked out paranoid or just have guns that have risen to the level of a psychoanalytic fetish, they're not going to call. And then I gotta call them and say, I just dream about wasting some perp, you know, like that. Yeah, you know, those of you who have called are probably the best example of the people who, in fact, could handle firearms safely. Overall, they, I think every study shows they don't provide much safety. And we found, too, one of the things.
But
that
I know a lot of people who would argue with
doesn't it make sense if you have a gun and there's somebody trying to do something to you? I mean, don't you watch television?
Now I do.
Yeah, bad guys, are stopped by good guys with guns.
Yeah, on television.
And sometimes in real life, too, as well. And there's been any number of times when people have protected their homes. And, I mean, you get, you know, guys chasing two teenage intruders down as the two are, you know, fleeing and shooting them in the back. And, I mean, you get that.
Wait, you remember doing this?
I did that, yeah. I had to. I had these two teenagers in my house. And I said,
you were a gangsta.
I was a gangbanger.
You were Which I did look it up. It can be the one or the other.
Look at it. What's the one I meant?
Well, it's vulgar slang to participate as an aggressor. Wait, no, sorry. Slang to participate in violent gang-related activity.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I meant.
But the other four
has to do with a sexual thing.
Yeah.
Okay, but more currently, it's the other thing. Here,
that was kind of more like a 70s bow chicka bow bow kind of thing, right?
Yeah, this is too, in a country so steeped in violence, this indelible culture of militarism, of gun ownership, and really was quite a thing this week. Pat from Mount Clemens writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Never thought I would say this, but congratulations to Republican Senator Rand Paul. I could not agree with him more on his filibuster considering, questioning the president's use of drones. Now, Rand Paul, who's got some pretty crazy ideas, gave this like 12-hour speech called a filibuster that stops the business of the Senate until he could get an answer to his question of whether or not the president had the legal right to kill Americans with drones inside of the United States.
Whoa.
Yeah. And Eric Holder, who is the attorney general, he kind of equivocated. And first he said yes, and then it would have, the president could conceivably have no choice but to authorize military use of such force if necessary to protect the homeland, which, people say, well, you got to protect the homeland. But the whole idea even of external violence, of somebody in the executive department determining the guilt or the presumed guilt or the future intentions of somebody and then assassinating them, That's a little far from American jurisprudence and constitutional guarantees. And at some level, most Americans, I think, don't care. They say, look, if you got to take some people out in another country, I really don't care.
Even if they're innocent civilians.
Well, there's always this high, what they call collateral damage, which generally means killing women and children that just happen to be around a, quote, bad guy. Except how is it determined that
whether that person
is a bad guy?
Bad,
or
right.
actually that person. That's
I mean, have we seen collateral damage? Bradley Manning's video. Those were journalists. Those were innocent people. They weren't doing anything.
Senator Rand Paul said he described the statement of the Attorney General as more than frightening and demanded to know the Obama administration's position on the subject. You know, I was thinking, and somebody said to me, you know, here that President Obama has just nominated somebody for, and I can't grab the story out of this pile right now. I can't remember the person's name, to be the Secretary of Energy, the head of the Energy Department.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's somebody that is pro-nuke, pro-coal, pro-fracking, where they shove tens of millions of gallons of water into the earth and
poisonous
to get natural gas out of there. He's increasing nuclear weapons. And they said to me, how could you tell people to vote for Barack Obama? You go back through all of the pre-election stuff, I never once said vote for Barack Obama. I said, do not vote
for Mitt Romney. Yeah, what you want to do outside of that.
Yeah. I mean, there is a continuity even in a lot of policies between George Bush and Barack Obama. I mean, Barack Obama has set a cultural context that is very progressive,
absolutely,
very tolerant, very important. But the things about now talking about putting Medicare and Social Security, what they call it, on the table, of essentially submitting to the
privatization,
or cuts in it,
let's not take care of our elderly. Let's say, it's not as if I know a lot of people who are caring for their elderly parents. And they're struggling to even afford their meds, be able to properly take care of these people. They've lived a long life. Don't they deserve the dignity of the same thing toward the end of their life?
Yes. Sorry. Were you wondering why did I laugh?
I know you're not laughing at that because I can see you.
Yeah, that's called an inappropriate.
You were reading something on the screen.
This is, let's see. Oh, Secretary of Energy, Dr. Ernest Moritz. Yeah, he's from MIT, as I remember. He's just a mouthpiece for the fossil fuel industry. And nukes, which we will talk about in a while.
Yeah.
But here's Tom from Canton. Tom called 313-298-WRIF, and he wants to know my definition of teabaggers. Is that it, Tom?
I called for two reasons,
and that was one of them.
I wanted some clarification on what do you mean by that term?
Well, originally, the people that formed
the Tea Party called themselves
teabaggers without realizing there was another meaning to it.
So you're just kind of playing on that joke.
Of course.
I didn't know that. See, I was under the impression that that term had been created by the mass media to kind of attack them for attacking the government.
They made a big mistake by calling themselves that. So
they didn't understand.
We're in the media. We're going to lob on to that, okay?
Even when people mean well, they tend to do some stupid things, you know? But the other reason I called is because earlier you made a point to point out some research that had been done about the massive gun scare and how all the guns are being bought off the shelves. And I have some personal experience in this matter.
Sure.
Personally, I am a United States Marine. You know, I swore an oath to defend my Constitution, United States of America, against all enemies, foreign and domestic. My contract may have ended, but I never saw an expiration date on my oath, and I still stand by that, and I still believe that that's an important thing. And I am a gun owner. I own a Sig Sauer SP 22 Pro Series, 9mm. But that's all I own. If I had the opportunity, I would go further. I might buy another weapon, probably an assault rifle, M16 style, but just because that's what I was trained to use and I am familiar with it.
What would you mean in case the Ruskies come across Alaska?
Actually, to be honest, the Sig Sauer, the pistol, suffices for home defense.
Right.
That's all I need. The AR would honestly be for recreation. recreational shooting. I enjoy the act of shooting. You know, there's a satisfaction when your round goes downrange and hits its target. But my point is that I have been to the stores and I've seen them empty. Whether you go to Dick's Sporting Goods, Glendier Mountain,
all of them.
Myers. The only rounds you can find at Myers are 22 caliber and shotgun shells.
I know, they're off the shelves.
I didn't even realize Myers
had them. The other point that you made about the ones buying up all the guns being the ones who already were gun owners.
Yeah.
It's absolutely true, and I know that from personal experience. Before this major gun scare, there were three guns in my house. I live with my parents.
Okay.
Shortly after this gun scare started starting up, I had gotten a job at a security company, and I acquired my pistol, and that made up four.
Okay.
Now, there's a total of 12 guns in my house, and they were all purchased by my father.
Yeah, okay.
And not only is he stockpiling these weapons, because he's terrified of his government, because the government has become so large. And I don't buy into all the conspiracy theories that he does.
But wait, why wasn't he, like, concerned when Bush was president? I mean, Bush expanded the government and, you know, did a lot of, you know, warrantless wiretaps and all that. I mean, it's kind of interesting that a guy that really functioned as an imperial president and many ways Obama's doing the same thing, but all of these people that all of a sudden are afraid of the government never seem to be afraid of it when George Bush, who got us into these wars and stuff like that, they didn't seem to be very concerned.
I agree. And to put it in his terms, he wasn't awake then, but he's awake now. But his reaction is an overreaction.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And we own a SWAT-style rifle, a Savage Tactical 308. It's a weapon that was originally designed for SWAT teams. He owns a Bushmaster AR. He owns a 30-30 lever action. My mother, which was one of the original guns we had, who she inherited from her father who passed away, a 22 caliber pistol.
Tom, let me stop you a minute. I'm way beyond when I'm supposed to go to commercials, but I just want to maybe you'd be the one to remind him of that. I mean, when people talk about they're getting guns for a defense against the government, that could mean Tom and his fellow Marines, right? Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to leave it at that. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Was that clear what I meant? I mean, when people say, I'm going to be armed against the government, first, the relationship of forces is so not in their favor that it's not even, it's silly to think about arming yourself to protect yourself against the government. But that would mean that you'd be protecting yourself against the forces of the government. That's what a government is, armed men.
Right.
Because, they kind of ask you nicely, and then if you don't do it, they send armed men to enforce the laws
now women
and who would come would be first police, then National Guard, and if you were really putting up some resistance, they'd send in the Marines and the 101st and stuff like that.
I actually feel sorry for people who are that paranoid and living in that state of fear. Tell your dad and relax a little.
And you know who stokes this? This is the NRA. This is the you know what they do when they get stoked, when they get paranoid? They go out and buy guns, and then what do the gun companies do? They contribute millions of dollars to the NRA.
It's all a
kind of a racket.
Circle.
All right, Michael and Scott, I want to get your views and also the rest of you. So you guys hang on. More of you call in 313-298-WRI. I have lots of subjects, and let's see. I got so many.
Well, we'll try to cover it all.
Oh, yeah. Hey, the stock market hit 14,000 and the unemployment? Talk about that when we get back as well.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
WRIF is hosting an exclusive College Hoops bracket party, and you could win a spot on the guest list. We're taking over Village Ford on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn on March 20th. We've created the ultimate game for guests to get their custom WRIF mini basketball that will win their spot onto Village Ford's basketball bracket. And the listener with the winning college team at the end of the tournament will win a $500 Visa gift card. It's a WRIF party, so guests will be treated to food, prizes, and rockin' games. Go to WRIF.com and enter to win your spot on the VIP guest list to party and win with WRIF in Village Ford.
The domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell is dedicated to leveling the playing field for men in divorce and now is offering complimentary 30-minute initial consultations. Men choose Cordell & Cordell because they want to feel that their interests and the interests of their children are aggressively championed. Everyone involved in a divorce is affected by the breakup of the family. Cordell & Cordell seeks to help you through this difficult time and to ensure your rights are protected so you can move on with your life. If you're a man confronted with a marriage you can't save, you should consider Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. To schedule your complimentary 30-minute initial consultation, please call 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com. Offices in Ann Arbor, Novi, and Troy.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, we were going to talk about, we've been talking about... Wait. I got to turn your mic on. Sorry. What?
Censoring me again. I see how you are.
It was.
Religion and guns.
Guns and religion.
Point, right?
Yeah. And one of the things we asked is
and drones.
And I thought that we would be deluged with calls when Jolene asked, does anybody read their Bible every day? Because we.
See, no one reads it.
Michael from Taylor does. We'll get him on the air in just a second. And the item was from the. Where did
it was
go?
A poll.
Oh, yeah. And it said that 40% of respondents said they're very religious, and they said it's an important part of their daily lives, and that they read their Bible every day. So let's hear from Michael in Taylor. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. So you have a phone app for it, Michael?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. I know. I actually know some people who do have the phone app, and they'll tease me and say, Julian, would you like to hear the daily verse? And oh, please. Go ahead, Michael. I'm not making fun.
Yes, she is, but don't. You don't care. They scorn Jesus.
Yeah, they do. I just wanted to let you guys know that I read my Bible every day. I have a phone app that I listen to at night that it also reads the Bible to me. But one thing I wanted to say was I still can live a normal life. I still listen to heavy metal.
Okay,
right.
I still have hair down to my butt. I've got 11 tattoos. I mean, it's...
I have more than you.
Do you really?
Yeah.
down to her butt, but I've never seen it. This is what the report. This is the report.
I believe Jesus Christ died for my sins, and I also give tithes every week, too. And that 10% that I give, I do not miss that. God has blessed me so much.
Now, I do not even miss it. Were you always religious, or did you find God at a certain point in your life?
Well, I'll tell you, I grew up going to church with my mom and dad. Actually, me and my sister were going to church. They were picking us up in a bus and taking us to church.
Mm-hmm.
And me and my sister asked my mom and dad to start going. And sure enough, they started going. They never stopped going.
Hmm.
But when I hit my college years, when I graduated high school, got out, started going to college, I discovered all kinds of stuff.
Oh, well, didn't we all?
I mean, have you discovered it all?
Sure.
And went that way for a little while, then started going to church on Mother's Day, Father's Day, Christmas, and Easter. The important holidays.
So, yeah, the big five or whatever it is.
Yeah, but 2005 is when I'm sorry, yeah, 2005 is when I really, really started becoming religious. My dad just kept planting that seed. And, I believe that God has kept me alive. I mean, I should have been dead three times. I've been on life support. I've wrecked on my dirt bike. It's crazy. I've developed pulmonary embolism.
Wow.
Well, sounds like, if somebody's up there, they got a plan. And you're part of it, Michael. That's good.
And you keep rocking. There's heavy metal Christian bands. I'm amazed by it.
All right, Michael, we got to run. So thank you for your story. Appreciate it greatly.
I know religious people can have a good time, too. I mean, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I know some crazy Catholics.
Just last night, I was at a big fundraiser, and there was a whole contingent of, Christians and Catholic peace activists and all that, mm-hmm. a big fundraiser.
But more atheists than anything.
Probably more atheists there. Yeah, but, we all get along.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Here's Terry in Canton. Terry, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Well, to top it all off, that guy is absolutely correct. I've had a lot of incidents like that, too. I'll get to what I was going to talk to you about earlier. But God does have a plan for everybody, whether most people believe or not. But because I've had angels on my wings for a lot of times.
Well, good to have them out there.
A couple times, you know. I'm lucky to be standing here. I got one in the leg and one in the back, and I'm still standing, so.
Well, good. What's the thing about the government and all that?
Telling the gentleman that answered the phone there, you guys are both right, and there's a female that was commenting as well. It's just a vicious circle because it's not an accident either. They do what they do. And that's why there's a lot of veterans that after they get out, you know, they just load up and they convince anybody they can to load up too because they find out all the dirties on the government, you know, and you join up. It's like, oh, be all you can be and all that. You do all you can do and you get out. I've been fighting to get my medical rights for years.
Yeah.
I'm just now getting, you know, part of what I deserve.
Like, what do you mean from?
You mean like SSI or something?
What's that now? Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, they put up a fight sometimes, don't they?
For years and years and years, you know?
Yeah.
It was way back since the early 80s when I got in. And after, you know, the Gulf War and everything, it just, there's so much crap. I got chemicals in my system.
Mm.
My legs are jacked up, my back's jacked up, you know, and they go, oh, there's nothing going on over there. There's no gender or whatever. Well, there's been some documentaries, some really good ones, too, on that military channel. I suggest everybody watch them if they got anything to do with the Gulf War. But back to the weapons, they have people that, will go out and get weapons because the government stirs these people up. And then all of a sudden, you know, you got these people that got multiple weapons.
Right.
They're being misused because they're not trained properly.
Right.
Somebody else gets a hold of them, like that kid or whatever.
Yeah.
You got criminals that are breaking into people's houses. They steal the stuff.
Right.
Go out and hurt people. And then you got more and more people going to court. And after they go to court, you know, the police get involved. And you got...
give me the point, though. What's the end of this?
He's connecting the dots, Peter.
Yeah, well, I want to hear the whole picture here.
That the government does what it does. The Bushes. I was so sick of Bush, I couldn't stand it.
Well, we were sick of him before he even decided to run.
Yeah. All right, Terry, I hope everything works out for you. I know a lot of people get too tough a time from SSI.
And your brain is still firing on all
going.
Synapses.
It's going.
You're just going. That's good.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening.
All right. This is sort of contradictory items that occurred 5 days apart. March 3rd, the New York Times reported recovery in the U.S. is lifting profits but not adding jobs. The Dow Jones, well, this is flirting with a record high. It actually hit it over 14,000 and what it's at, something like 14,300. This is how, the stock market is measured. I mean, years and years ago, it was like 250. Now it's like 14,300. Mm-hmm. And so now we're out of the recession because the indicators of the economy, which is an abstraction, of course, because it doesn't include you or your neighbor or your father or your children or whoever doesn't have a job or is getting some job that, after they've been fired, they get something for half of what they received initially. But according to the statistics about the economy, We're out of the recession. Oh, you lost your home? You know people that have lost their home? Oh, yeah. 40,000 homes. 40,000 homes in Detroit were in foreclosure. Oh, don't, you know, the stock market is over the top. So how does it affect you? Well, the top 1% own about 50% of all the stock. The rest of it then is scattered a little bit through the rest of it, you know, depending on how far, how close you are. Like if you're in the 99th percentile, well, you got a lot more than somebody that's in the 9th percentile, which has none. Right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I lost my little sheet of paper then, and I never like to quote statistics that are not,
accurate.
Well, or that I, can't. What is it? There's lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Yeah,
that's the worst. And what is it? Figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Uh-huh.
That's one of my favorites,
yes,
right? And so, all right, so the recovery in the U.S. lifting profits, but not adding jobs. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average flirting with the record high. It's already passed it. The split between American workers and the companies that employ them is widening and could worsen in the next few months as the federal budget cuts take hold. This is the sequester thing and all that. The Gulf helps explain why stock markets are thriving even as the economy is barely growing and unemployment remains stubbornly high. With millions out of work, companies face little pressure to raise salaries, while productivity gains allow them to increase sales without adding workers. Now, I don't know,
I think there's a lot of pressure to give people raises because now is when they need them, but they...
Well, that's not a real pressure.
They can't.
The pressure is that if you depend on the market, you know, so when you get these conservatives, they want a free market. They also want a free market in labor, which means if you had it completely, if you didn't have unions, you didn't have a minimum wage, a lot of people would be working for about $2.75 an hour because that would be the market pressure. So what we want is to artificially raise the selling price of labor, of our labor as workers. But so there's little pressure to raise salaries. And what's happened? There's been all this productivity gains, but everything from it has gone to the upper 10% and particularly the upper 1% and particularly that 0.1% that really owns everything. They own you, as George Carlin said. If you don't know that particular, and you guy swears a little in it, just Google George Carlin. They own you.
It's worth it for sure.
I'm thinking
most Carlin's worth it.
Why don't we even do radio? Why don't I just say, hey, why don't you
go watch old Carlin YouTube?
This guy nails it more than I ever could. Yeah, it's amazing. He's absolutely amazing. But let's see. I usually underline all this. Oh, here, yeah. As a percentage of national income, corporate profits stood at 14.2% in the third quarter. A lot of this, you're going, what the hell does that mean? But it's the largest share of corporate profits anytime since 1950, while the portion of income that went to employees was near its lowest point since 66. So wealth is being created. See, this is what, there's always wealth distribution and redistribution, except, as I always say, it's only going one way. It's all going up. We work, our productivity has increased, but all of the wealth that has come from the increased productivity has not been shared in the slightest. They would call that a redistribution of income. I would call it a redistribution of income, and it would actually work to the benefit. The people in charge aren't as smart as they claim to be. They're just rich, so they control things. Here's what one of the things they do. I just learned this. You know, they have when a radio signal, like I'm talking right now, and almost instantaneously it's coming out. Well, actually, this is on what, like a 30-second delay or something?
We need a little delay on this show.
Yeah. But if it wasn't, as soon as I spoke, if you were, had a radio in the other room, you'd hear it like virtually simultaneously.
Yes.
But there's a nanosecond difference, and particularly over the Internet, where increasingly stock sales are done. So these companies, they open up stock market, what do they call it?
Also, I can't trading? Remember.
Speed trading companies. And they are right next to the place where they're sending out the information. All right? So you're going to buy a stock at, say, $3.50 or $33. Let's make it $33.50.
Okay.
So you hit buy. they get that information that you placed a buy order for 350, and they can buy the stock at say like $33.50 and .0001 cents, right? And so you actually wind up buying it for just this fraction more, and then if they're doing millions and even billions
it adds up.
Of trade, they're making billions, hundreds of millions and billions of dollars a year.
Wow.
I mean, so what are they producing, particularly that sector? I mean, not forgetting about the fact
it's
that...
It's like air.
Yeah. it's usually been called a con game.
Yes, right? Sure.
It's usually a con game. Corporate earnings have risen at an annualized rate of 20% since the end of 2008. So they've gone up 20%. Disposable income, that's what you and I have inched up by 1.4% annually.
Yeah, speak for yourself, disposable income. Yeah. Who has that anymore?
Yeah. All right, let's take some more calls. Here's Rob. Rob's in Woodhaven. Rob, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good night. Good evening, Pete and Jillian. I just called in because I'm 46, and I have a lot of friends that went to Iraq and Afghanistan, and actually my 17-year-old daughter signed up for the Marine Corps. And my point is that I hear a lot of people whining about being a veteran.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand it. I mean, my uncle was a Vietnam War vet, and I lost two people in World War II, and they laid it down. My uncle, I took him to the VA. He had pancreatic cancer. He sucked it up. He did it. He liked it there. He liked the people there. And
I understand what you're saying. Here,
it's different now.
Yeah, it's different now. These were big patriotic war that had the entire country behind them.
They lifted them up as heroes.
You know how many people protested World War II? Not a lot.
Right. Yeah, and now people are coming back, and the government, the Department of Defense, they're not taking care of these veterans.
And also, the public knows now that George Bush lied us into a war in Iraq. That never should have been fought, never needed to be fought. And these are men and women that risked their lives, that saw their friends and comrades die or get blown apart. And the same thing with a lot of Vietnam veterans. I mean, every war has its post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. I mean, they call it shell-shocked, or I forgot, there was other names for it in different wars. But being in a war and being that close to death and dealing out death.
Seeing
the result of it, and particularly in these kind of wars where, you know, you wind up with so many civilians being killed and all of that. And then, you know, no victory parades, we defeated Hitler and the Japanese Empire, and in Vietnam, well, lost. It was a loss. There was Grenada.
Right.
Yeah. There was Panama, you know, where they had to go capture the dictator who previously was the friend of the U.S. and the friend of the president.
Which is usually how it goes.
Yeah, you know, that George Bush the Elder, when the dictator of Panama was a CIA asset. So they went and to capture him on a drug warrant and wound up killing 4,000 or 5,000 innocent civilians in Panama City. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that makes the military proud. I'm actually surprised that there's a high esprit de corps, that there's actually a high spirit as they have. And I'd be interested to know, and maybe some of the vets can call in that joined recently, that given what they see, lack of support, so many scandals about this, Jolene said, the refusal to give the proper care. After they come back.
Of some of these hospitals.
Yeah, the fact that they've seen what happens to people and that there's so little support. What was the impetus to join?
Yeah, right. And remember, even during the Bush years, the deaths were so shoved under the rug that they didn't want the big media to show when a coffin came back.
Yeah.
They said, don't do it.
All right, thanks for raising that. I appreciate that very much. Well, rather, if I get anybody on right now, we're going
to have to cut them short.
Cut them short. So
do a commercial break.
give us an idea of maybe how you evaluated, well, first, why you joined and how you evaluated your experience after and never received those kind of Jimmy Stewart, you know, World War II yeah. or Sergeant York, World War I, when Johnny came marching home kind of things.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
You're smart enough to know when a deal seems too good to be true, like a no-sweat workout plan or a $5 prime rib buffet. But when you're shopping for car insurance, it's surprisingly easy to get duped into crummy coverage. That's why Esurance created the Coverage Counselor, an online tool to help you choose the right coverage for you at a great price. Too good to be true? Nope. Just insurance for the modern world. Esurance. Now backed by Allstate. Click or call.
Coverage Counselor highlights options to consider in choosing coverage. Not available in all states.
How do you keep an older car running like new? Just ask a Ford customer.
Jackie, tell me why somebody should bring their car here to the Ford dealership for service instead of those other places.
They have wonderful service. I come and make sure I get my oil changed, and when they tell you your tires need to be rotated, you got to get that done as well.
The Works, $39.95 or less, minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, and disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details with 33113.
As your HR rep, it's my duty to alert everyone to the newest pandemic spreading across our nation called desk dining. It's caused by repeatedly eating lunch at one's desk. Its symptoms include a rotten attitude and constant blank staring out of the window. My official recommendation is to start eating lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings, the cure-all to lameness caused by desk dining. Except for you, Phil. You'd be lame no matter where you eat.
With tons of big screens and more delicious menu items for less cash, we're the perfect place for lunch. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
I want it now!
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
I want it now!
The Riff.
I want to hear the revolution!
Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. At 1 a.m., I'll have a couple of interesting interviews. A guy that's written a book about oligarchies. What's an oligarchy? Come on, you know what that is.
Peter.
That's, yeah, when a few people run things. And we're supposed to have a democracy. In other words, you know, the word demographic, it means everybody, sort of. But
a collective of sorts.
No. A lot of people don't like that.
I know they don't.
Yeah. But
we love it.
We have a democracy. We have democratic means to elect people within the republic, so don't get crazy on me, folks. And then the absolutely amazing Grace Lee Boggs, a 94-year-old lifetime activist who's got so many great ideas. So she'll be on at, I think, at 1:30 it is.
And we will she's definitely. From here. I mean, this is a Detroiter.
Yeah. She will, that will all be on the podcast as well, because I didn't screw up this week like I did last week.
But it has been confirmed that the interviews from last week are on WhiteRoseSociety.org. It's called The Peter Werby Show. I think, Ben, you better put little Julie's name on of these days.
Hey, you know what the White Rose Society was? You remember that?
I do. I remember, but
they were these kids in Nazi Germany that were into jazz music and were opposed to the Nazis, and they actually all got executed. Very, very creepy. So you're wondering why? I mean, I guess what he's talking about is resistance against fascism.
Sure.
Hey, go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. We'll have a podcast available in just about 12 hours. And John Miller, thank you for doing that.
And he's taking your phone calls as well, 313-298-WRIF.
Yep. So anyway, I was saying that so corporate profits are up. Nothing, though, happening much with the jobs, or is it? Hey, it just dropped down. It went down from 7.9% to 7.7%. And I suppose if you were one of the people who got the job, that probably does seem like a lot. But I think even now the mainstream media is reporting that probably there's a total of about 14 million people of discouraged workers, people that are working way beyond what they had previously and what have you. And the question is this what is going to be the future? Is it going to be the present, and is it going to be the future? Are these the good old days?
Like, how long is this going to last? Yeah, or is this how it is?
And some of you are, of course, probably thinking, "What? What's the deal? Everything's cool. I got a nice car. I go, you know, go to the bar every Friday and Saturday. Got a nice, expensive watch and all that." Hey, by the way, one of the reasons
and that, good for you, good on you.
Yeah, one of that 1%. Well, I mean, you got to recognize that everyone isn't in the same boat.
That's right.
Some people are working that the minimum wage will not buy one of these fancy mixed drinks that are now anywhere from $9 to $15.
That's just absolutely insane.
Yeah.
I think that's crazy. I refuse to do it.
You won't drink a $15 drink?
Hell no. I'll do one of those $9 martinis at the Chirino down the block.
Where was I?
Good.
I was at, you know, there's this great soul food restaurant in Southfield called
Beans and Cornbread.
Yeah, Beans and Cornbread. And they have a Obama martini.
Do they really?
Yeah.
Love it.
Obama, is that right? Obama
martini. It's probably Obama-tini.
Obama-tini, yeah.
Yeah, did you have it?
No, it was $9.
Well, maybe if you split with someone to make it a little economic.
It was lunch anyways.
But, oh, yeah. Yeah. Didn't want to do the one martini, two martini, three martini floor.
Yeah, right. I never heard that before. Really?
Are you serious?
Yeah, that's cool.
Well, it's like I didn't make it up. It's
anyway,
like a T-shirt.
Back, I forgot about this. I did find my little piece of paper. But recovery in the U.S. is lifting profits but not adding jobs. And the way this money is being allocated, since what we're talking about, as although the companies are not dispersing these, I forgot what it is. I always say it. But they've got over $1 trillion. Maybe it's trillions if someone... John Miller, go to the Google. Tell us how much cash on hand American corporations have. And they're not investing it. They're not, they got it in things like treasury bills and all that. They're not doing, anything with it. They're not hiring people. They're not doing research. They're not opening up new places or anything like that. They're just literally sitting on this amazing amount of money. And a number of stockholder groups say, could this be dispersed, please? In other words, they want to increase their 1% status, and they know when this money is dispersed, they are going to pay for it at 15%. They're not going to pay for it at the rates that you and I do as workers, and it's not going to be charged. They're not going to be subject to payroll tax, the FICA tax.
Much less stressful for them.
So why in the world would the wealthy, this 1% that owns 50% of the stock in America, why would they get this free ride of only having to pay 15%? Well, the theory was, this again is this insane Reaganomics that caused all this mess in the first place, that these were the job creators. Of course, as we see, evidence over and over and over again. They do not create squat. They don't want to create squat. They don't want to create a job for you. They certainly don't want to create a good job for you. Maybe they'll find a $7.75 an hour job, but they don't want to have those old fashioned jobs like they used to have in auto and everywhere else like that. And the idea was, since these were the job creators, that it would be an inducement to invest. In other words, if you got a tax break on your investment, you could get wealthy people to invest, and then that money would be invested in the economy, and then the economy would bloom, and there'd be jobs, and it'd be a huge middle class. Everything has gone the absolute opposite way. So one of the things that's needed, and here you get the Republicans who are, they're defending the rich like they're defending the ramparts against the assault from the barbarians at the gates, right? They're buddies who pay their bills who say, no, don't let them take any more money from us. Although their tax rates on the rich is lower than it's ever been. Lower than it's ever been. It's gone up a teeny weeny bit. But it's historically at a historic low. All right, let's get some more of you on the air. Where I've totally lost to all this. I asked the question
what
why
you
young
your
people
mind? What are you...
lost my mind. Yeah. But I asked the question why, given that people today join the armed services, given the horrendous injuries they see, the fact that there are people now say that that Bush's war in Iraq bordered on criminality. Some people think it was because he lied about it, knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, saw the damage done to Iraq and Afghanistan, saw that this is not going to be a big victory. There's not going to be Johnny come marching home and on and on. The government not taking proper care of the vets. So why did they join? Here's Joe from Sterling Heights. Joe, you got an idea, or did you do it?
Yeah, I did, actually. And people joined for a variety of reasons, and mine was more economic. Yeah. But, you know, you get guys that are kind of, seduced by the propaganda, I guess you'd say, you know, like, let's roll, you know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Yes.
And, there's other people that, you know, just they went the college route and it didn't work out for them and maybe they don't know what to do. So, hey, I'll join the Army.
Well, Joe, I actually saw somebody on television. They were at the news. They were dismantling a base in Afghanistan. So they knew as soon as they dismantled the base, the Taliban was going to come back in. They'd lost 40 men at this base. So you think, like, what was this for? It would come through my mind. But the officer there said that he was motivated, and we've heard this before, by 9/11.
Yes,
he said this so marked his consciousness. But what occurs to me when if people don't, like today, see these wars that they could be easily inserted into, the coming back with horrendous injuries or killed, that would make me think, I'm going to take my chances on the economy on the outside. Maybe they're really desperate. I don't know.
Yeah, but you also have to remember that not all jobs in the military are combat arms.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's a good chance, even if you joined while both wars were going on, if you go into finance, you know, or petroleum resupply, you know, unless you get pulled to go on a convoy, you know, you're hanging out on a forward operating base, a FOB, 12 hours a day, you know?
Yeah.
For a year or however long your deployment is.
Are you still in the service?
I just was discharged. Honorably discharged. Thank you.
Are you sorry you did? I mean, you got out okay, but you must have, where were you, if I may ask?
I did funerals. I traveled around, honor guard type thing, and didn't deploy.
Well, that's an honorable and tough, role to play.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was something that I was pulled for, you know, they pick soldiers that, you know, look a certain way and, you know, PT scores, whatever. People join for different reasons.
Sure. If you had it to do over again, would you do it?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I had a lot of fun in the military. It's like no other job. You know, some people knock it. You know, it's not for everybody.
Yeah.
Fun doesn't come to mind when it comes to war. You know, I can't imagine. But, I mean, probably the camaraderie of you and your...
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Joe. You gave us a great insight. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe,
very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. We were talking a little earlier about Rand Paul, who's got high... He's a senator from Kentucky. He's far right-wing libertarian. His father is...
Ron Paul.
Yeah, Ron Paul. thank you. How soon we forget. The only guy that even made a modicum of sense for all the, remember those Republican debates? What a circus that was.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, both liberals and libertarians were very supportive of Rand Paul's filibuster, demanding that he get answers about the Obama administration drone policy and killing United States extrajudicial, as they call it, essentially assassinating people. So we've come a long way. Now great parts of the country defend torture. They defend the execution, essentially the assassination of people that have been designated by somebody as an enemy of the state. But here's Paul from Sterling Heights. Paul thinks that Rand Paul is a hypocrite. Why is that, Paul?
Again, I'm going to try and keep this as narrow as possible.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Rand Paul, at one time, said that he would like to see unmanned drones used to defend the U.S.-Mexican border.
Oh, that's right. He did.
Wow.
He's right.
I wonder what happened there.
Yeah.
No.
Look. These guys don't like the family that lives in our White House.
Well, that's true.
I don't know why. But I have to say that Rand Paul has argued in defense of any business owner who would like to hang a whites-only sign in their doorway.
Did he do that? I mean, I know that his father said that he would have not supported a lot of. I got to make sure someone. There's a few Remember all those people were all excited about Ron Paul, maybe, and there was, what's our friend there?
I was just thinking about him earlier in the show, Ron Paul Rick at East
Ron
Point.
Ron Paul Rick.
Yeah, haven't heard from him forever.
Yeah, yeah, I think
but
he's kind of.
Where are you, Ron?
He's kind of, not
Ron.
Ron
Rick?
Ron. But, there were things that, that they feel the government does not have the right to interfere in commerce, because commerce is the most important thing, the market above everything, no matter if people are using their power within the market to discriminate against people or what have you. But, I mean, those laws that said you cannot discriminate in public accommodation, you can't be licensed by the government or the state and then decide you're not going to let in, fill in the blank, blacks, women, Jews, Italians. I mean, who hasn't been shut out along our history? Irish, all of that. Asians. So, but their argument is, hey, it's private property. You can do what you want. If you don't like it, if they say you can't come in, you should go to the place.
Is that like Augusta? Remember the Masters? Can women still not go there?
I don't know. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate that. It is one way to look at things. I think what really argues against all of that is the talk in all of our documents and our pledges and all that about liberty and justice for all, the general welfare, what else? I mean, there's any number of statements within these foundation documents. And, I mean, I always say, initially what they were talking about were white men, right?
Yes.
Only.
Yes.
White free men only. Mm. But what happened? What they call these revolutions, the democratic revolutions, expanded in their inclusiveness. So now the most reviled groups are no longer being forced to the margins. Did we actually even talk about this?
Not always.
Well, no. It's a record number of Californians now approve of allowing same-sex couples to marry. This poll found 78% support among people 39 and younger, and a solid majority of middle-aged residents now back gay marriage. Even among senior citizens, there was a plurality, 48% to 42%. In other countries, they're still murdering gays.
Yes, that's right.
African countries, Arab countries,
yes,
and what have you. So it's kind of hard to, as far as I'm concerned, to say you have this constitution that says it's all inclusive in terms of rights.
Except for you and you and you.
Yeah. Wrong gender, wrong religion, wrong skin color, wrong creed.
Racism is so more alive than I care to even think about for a second. It's awful.
All right, actually, this is interesting. We'll go through these kind of quickly. We'll we'll do it in this order. Michael and Scott and Maurice. Michael.
And we have a few open lines, by the way, if you want
313-298-WRIF, and I'm just going to announce in advance what they're going to talk about to keep them on message. Michael from Fenton said Detroit should go bankrupt rather than other options available. Scott from Westland talks about delinquent taxes in Detroit. Remember last week we said 50% of homeowners do not pay their taxes. Many of them can't afford it. Many of them say, hey, I am getting no services.
Yeah, you don't show up.
You're not getting any taxes. And Maurice is going to talk about the emergency financial manager in Detroit. All right. So let's begin with Michael in Fenton. Michael, thanks for your patience. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, what was that? How do you say that? How do you say that? Oligarchy?
Oligarchy.
Oligarchy.
Oligarchy, the rule of a few.
Yeah, that's what they got that manager down there. That's what that is. But
No. That's a dictatorship. Although oligarchy would be okay. That would be an improvement. But no, what happens is, I don't understand how this could even, and I'm sorry, I just cut you off right away. I'm going to let you speak your full piece. But I don't understand how these emergency financial manager laws can pass constitutional muster. In other words, a financial manager can come in and say, all right, this waste hauler contract with these union workers is too expensive. Even though the city of Detroit has made a contract with this company and with this union, we're abrogating it and we're going to get it picked up for people making $8 an hour. Maybe you could make the argument that's all that it should be paying, or it made an extravagant contract or whatever. But I thought, going back to capitalism and based on contractual relationships, how in the hell could one guy, a dictator, do that? Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about Detroit going bankrupt. You remember Bernie Madoff? He, you know how they caught him, was that he was doing the same thing that the government was doing, so that's how they knew what he was up to, because, you know, that's what they're doing. But as far as Detroit goes, they need to go bankrupt, because then they could just start all over instead of throwing all that money that they're going to spend on trying to dig out of this hole that they're never going to get out of. They could spend that on taking care of business after they go bankrupt. So it's very simple. Is they need to get any kind of city manager, just forget all that. Tell Michigan State, the state of Michigan, to jump in a lake and just go bankrupt and start over.
Well, I don't know. I suppose that's one way to do it. I mean, I think it's a much bigger problem. I mean, why is there always sort of a wheel of misfortune that there's always some place in the richest country in the world that's under the hammer, getting screwed, not enough money to pay its bills? If you just go down Woodward Avenue and go through Detroit and then Highland Park.
I did it today, yeah.
Yeah, and then you go up and you hit Ferndale, and then you're Pleasant Ridge, and then Royal Oak, and then Birmingham. And what's there? I mean, what is it that the farther north you get, the people there are more skilled at managing their affairs, that somehow the brighter, that these people were so bright that they managed to keep, well, no.
Some people think that way, though.
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, it is a class stratification, so the areas of which are poor, I mean, always got, even at the height of Detroit, or the height of Ecorse, or some of these other cities that have financial managers, always had bad schools, bad roads, high crime, and what have you. So there's a lot to have this disparity of wealth that go to these municipalities. Like in a state, if you have schools that are so bad and you have underperforming kids, why wouldn't that be the school system that would be getting the most amount of money per pupil rather than the least? Yeah. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah, it really is.
So you have the most going to the kids in the richest areas, and that's because they're going to replace their parents in the upper class structure. And you know the people at the bottom of the pyramid, of the social and wealth pyramid, they're going to replace their parents either in bad jobs or no jobs, they're going to wind up to be clients for the prison industrial system. So it, you know, this system works better than people let on in an evil way. In an evil way, this system works kind of perfectly, in a very perverse manner, which I would say has to be altered dramatically. All right. Thank you very much.
Yes. For sure.
Here's Scott in Westland. Wants to talk about delinquent taxes in Detroit. And I said earlier, 50% of the people not even paying them. What do you think from out there in Westland, Scott, about Detroit?
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jalene.
Hi,
I just want to complete my thought from last week. First, actually, I want to make a brief apology to the local Fox News affiliate, WJBK. Because I think we were both doing the funky chicken on Fox News, and I just want to say that I actually like the local affiliate. Charlie LaDuff was just on Bill Maher.
Hey, Scott, you're about a second away from going bye-bye. Tell me about delinquent taxes in Detroit. Later for the funky chicken.
Okay, well, all right. What I want to say is you're right that actually you could apply the medical principle of triage to this, that
right.
There are three categories. Some of this money will never be recovered. These are houses that are going to be foreclosed anyway, and when you sell the house, the property isn't even worth what's owed in property taxes. Some of it is like elderly people and poor who, if anything, need some assistance paying their property taxes.
Sure.
And maybe they just haven't gotten it together to get into some of the programs that exist for that. But there's a third category in this huge chunk, 47%, 50% of people who are able to pay and aren't, who basically, and that's what you would call the low-hanging fruit. So, and I'm not into the emergency manager thing too much, but if you're going to put some money into Detroit, from the state, the tax assessor's office could use some assistance to go after people who are basically not paying their property taxes, not because they can't, but because they know they can get away with it, and they are. Because
well, it's not only just that I mean, obviously, if there was going to be a tax foreclosure, they would probably come up with the money. There's a great number of people who can't afford it. But the other hand, can you imagine Detroit being a relatively poor city or maybe absolutely poor city? Can you imagine having to come up with a couple grand or $4,000, and then when you call the police, they don't come, and the garbage isn't picked up, and there's not street lights and stuff like that? I mean, talk about adding, well, they talk about insult to injury. That's just really injury to injury. All right, thank you very much.
I mean, living in the inner city is already stressful enough as it is.
Now, here's strange. Here's somebody from Detroit talking about it.
Maurice.
Hi, Maurice. Hi, you're on the air. What's up?
Hello, Julian.
Hello.
How you doing? Okay.
We're good.
So you would think that the person with the background of Mayor Bain, being competitive, wouldn't give up the way he did on the emergency financial manager.
Yeah.
You know what? His boy ain't got no balls. You know, even when you lose, you still play like the win.
No, he should know that from his sports career, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you know what? You know, you could take him for the gas to San Francisco, and I'd drive him to the airport. Leave Detroit. We don't need you.
Oh, he wants Bing to go.
Trade him.
Trade him.
We can trade your ass. You know, we're just giving you your unconditional release. If people had enough sense in Detroit, they would have recalled him. He would have got recalled in the suburb.
Well, here's what's going on. I think the council is challenging it, and also a number of the labor unions and some other groups are actually going to begin a lawsuit against its designation. It's like I said, I mean, is it really constitutional? There's got to be a lawyer out there listening or somebody that's a little more steeped in this kind of stuff than I am. But on the face of it, how can you just abrogate contracts because this one man, like, you know, Michael from Fenton said that this is oligarchy. No, it's not oligarchy. It's a dictatorship. If you have one guy in the school system or of a number of places or in the city. All right, Maurice, thanks for the report.
I can see why he would think that. I mean, I could see why he was going toward that, Mike and Fenton. I get where he made that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's get Rick from Farmington Hills on. Hey, Rick. Hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how y'all guys doing?
We're good. Thanks for calling in.
Rick, you know, Rick needs a radio job. Listen to those
pops. Yeah, I know.
You know, I grew up in the city of Detroit just like all of us did. And this is nothing but greed and thievery going on. It's been going on for I don't know how long. Look at the people. Monica Conyers, Kwame Kilpatrick. All of them been stealing, even the people on the city council. So I don't see why everybody thinks it's so bad. You know, you can do something for so long, then people get tired of the excuses and all the BS that's going on.
Well, as you probably know.
And Monica paid her price.
Yeah, she just got out, by the way.
Yeah, isn't she in like a halfway?
Maybe so. Yeah. But there was, I don't have my Detroit history in front of me, but there was a mayor that was, what would you call, not impeached, but I mean, the corruption. I mean, city corruption. I mean, in fact, Kwame Kilpatrick is more like the mayors of yore, the kind of mayors of Chicago and New York and all these big cities that it was always just a big loot fest. And wasn't it Mayor Mariani who I think went to federal prison, right, for a scam? So corruption is nothing new and nothing that shouldn't be fought all the time, and that the wink and the nod to it just corrupts a city terribly. But the rug was not pulled out from under Detroit by anybody, beyond Jerry Kavanaugh in the 1960s. It was because of the deindustrialization of Detroit. Probably, if Kwame Kilpatrick would have been around in the 1940s and 1950s, he wouldn't have got prosecuted. They probably would have been called Kwame Kilpatrick Hall instead of Cobo Hall or something like that.
And here's another thing.
Yeah.
The governor's the biggest thief of them all.
Why do you say that?
This guy has money already.
He does.
He already has money.
Yep.
He don't care. You know, it's just like, go back to the movie thing. We would have been making a whole lot of money.
Yep.
But he didn't get his little paws in there, so hey, what do you do? Cut it out.
Oh, I mean, for the tax thing. And the
so,
movies.
You know, they're all crooked so far as I'm concerned. I'm trying to get out of here. Because I'm tired. I've been home for 7 years, and I've seen nothing but mayhem.
Where are you going?
I was in California for 28 years.
Yeah, but we need people with your mind here in Detroit. Don't go.
Yeah, I don't. You know, people leave. I cross them off.
He will cross you off. Don't
cross me off. I'm a fellow brother. Come
okay. Hey, you know, Rick, there was a saying, and maybe you could do this. I was born in Detroit. I'm going to die in Detroit, but I'm not going to live in Detroit.
Yeah, well, I'm always going to have a heart of the D. Yeah, but I mean,
right.
This is ridiculous.
You know what?
I lived in
Miami, and I chose to move back here to Detroit.
Like the winners.
It was Peter. Yeah. What can I say? Stay away from the man.
All right, Rick, thank you so much as usual. Don't leave the Motor City.
Don't leave us.
Yeah, you know how it is. Everybody, when were we talking about this? Everybody, you know, they down Detroit so much. And then, yeah, we did. We said it last year when, you live in Sterling Heights or Taylor or, Roseville or someplace like that. And you're somewhere else. And they say, where are you from? They say, I'm from Detroit.
I'm from the D, man.
I'm
the
from
big
the D.
D.
Yeah. But what did that make me think of? Something, probably. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike. Mike is in Clyde. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hit that button there.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I did. Hey, Mike, now you're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, okay, thanks. I was just wondering if you know any of the statistics that say whether or not any Republican areas have had financial managers, or it's only an area where there's Democratic population strengths that are slowly being destroyed.
When it really gets down to it, except for one city, isn't there a downriver city that, I mean, most of the cities have been predominantly African American, like Flint and Ecorst, what's the one? Benton Harbor. Yeah, and what have you. And the wave, those are areas that always suffer the hardest economically. So they're the ones that are going to run into the financial difficulty.
Birmingham is not having the issue where they're trying to get an emergency manager.
And you can see, and usually, because people's sense of history goes back about 3 or 4 days, because who was it was just talking? Oh, yeah, it was just Rick was talking about. Wasn't him talking about Monica Conyers and Kwame Kilpatrick? Well, there's a lot of other people, you know, that go back before that. I mean, as I'm sure Rick knows. If you see Michael Moore's first movie, which totally goes out of my brain.
Anyway. Roger and Me.
When he tries.
I almost said Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's getting late.
Yeah. And people used to call him Roger Moore all the time.
Right.
Yeah. But the James Bond guy. But you can see there what happens to a city that's deindustrialized. So it's not the people that were left. The people that were left are the people that were poor to begin with. Because of social and economic and racial reasons, they were disproportionately poor out of the gate. So then when the rug is completely pulled out from under the economy, and it's not done by Coleman Young, and it's not done by, I can't remember who, all the other mayors that came after, it's the brainiacs that decided they could make a few cents an hour more by deindustrializing Detroit, and instead of having jobs done here by union middle-class people, white and black, that they could get it done by next to nothing by brown and yellow people in the countries where they live. In other words, they were willing to destroy Detroit. So Kwame Kilpatrick did not destroy Detroit, corrupt as hell.
He helped to do some serious damage, don't you think?
No, I don't even think that. I mean, it kind of...
A little damage. Okay.
How about
the reputation?
Reputation down the drain, and was dispiriting certainly to people in which... the people that live in Detroit and people that can identify with Detroit surely didn't need. You know, his jury's been out a long time. There's people that are saying it might be a mistrial, or I don't think there's going to be not.
I mean, this has been weeks, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a long time. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we have. I'm sorry. We've got Mike from Clyde just kind of hanging around there. Mike, so you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying?
But I was just wondering, though, if you think it's actually trying to weaken the Democratic voting base by doing that.
Well, I sure do, because one of the things that these managers want to do, and there's sort of a built-in rationalization for it, you can say these union contracts are bid out at too much for a struggling city to have. So we got to get rid of these unions and have it all privatized. And so that means you destroy these unions, which are the basis of the Democratic Party, which is also, though, they're the basis of the expanded middle class and have been for at least 30 years until under Reaganomics they began to be purposely destroyed for both political and economic reasons. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Good point.
Thanks for
That's
calling.
A good point. Yeah. We're going to take a break and come back and they're talking about, Fermi 1. We almost lost Detroit.
Uh-huh.
Fermi 2 had a lot of problems.
Yep.
So there's only one thing to do, right? If you're DTE, Fermi 3. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julian Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julian will be taking more of your calls right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
WRIF is hosting an exclusive College Hoops bracket party, and you could win a spot on the guest list. We're taking over Village Ford on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn on March 20th. We've created the ultimate game for guests to get their custom WRIF mini basketball that will win their spot onto Village Ford's basketball bracket. And the listener with a winning college team at the end of the tournament will win a $500 Visa gift card. It's a WRIF party, so guests will be treated to food, prizes, and rockin' games. Go to WRIF.com and enter to win your spot on the VIP guest list to party and win with WRIF in Village Ford.
us your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much. Hey, join us on Facebook, facebook.com/nightcall. Always a lot of things going on. You know, the only thing I've noticed missing from our Facebook page lately is less comments.
Yeah?
You notice that?
Maybe.
Okay. So you can go on there and comment.
I'll pay a little more attention.
Jalene posts things. Here's the way it goes. I post things on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, which is, I know, so 20th century. But I'm a 20th century man. That's a Kink song. You know that one? I'm a 20th century man, but I don't want to be
that
him.
One, yeah.
Ruled by bureaucracy. The Kinks are very political.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Very. But where were we? Oh, yeah, Facebook page. And you can check it on out. We like to be liked. You can hook in with what we're doing, and you can make some comments. All right.
Welcome to.
Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. I've mentioned this before. We actually had some people as guests on the air. I have a couple of guests in about 25 minutes. One talking about oligarchy. And suddenly when somebody was thinking about it, it occurred to me it's not actually a common word. Oligarchy means the rule of a few. In fact, it's more well-known because that's what they call the people that took over the Russian industry and financial industry and all that. They call them the oligarchs,
mm-hmm.
like that. One of the few things, this is pretty arrogant, one of the few things I was wrong about ever is
Did you just say ever?
Yeah. Politically, at least, was okay. That when the Soviet Union began to fall apart and when the countries in the Soviet bloc freed themselves from Soviet domination, I said, they're probably still going to have a socialized economy. I said, what are they going to do? Have a lottery to see who gets the industry? But somehow, mostly these ex-Communist Party apparatchiks just kind of, I'm not even sure how the ownership, private ownership, established itself in those countries. Mm-hmm. But, so now we have all these Russian billionaires. Don't they own, like U.S. sports teams and condos in they own like condos in the famous Plaza Hotel in New York City. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
They get a lot of money. So that archy means how you rule, starting off with anarchy, which means mm-hmm. no ruler at all.
Matriarchy.
Yeah. And in terms of rule, which is rule, right? Patriarchy and matriarchy. But also you have a democracy. Oh, that's an ocracy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not an archy.
Yeah.
There goes that.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. There goes my argument. Yeah, well. But one of the ones, and here are, let's give John Miller, a heightened title. Let's call him our producer. He's producing.
I already do call him that.
Don't we call him like our co-producer, our assistant producer?
I call him our producer.
Our producer.
I gave him that title a long time ago.
Yeah, but plutocracy. Plutocracy. That is the rule of the rich. How did Pluto, like they used to call him the plutocrats in like 100 years ago or uh-huh. so or more, around the beginning in the 1890s. And this is the way the radical agrarian movement, they were, by the way, whenever you hear people being called radical, it means they're not going for things as they are.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was a radical agrarian movement because they didn't want to be crushed by the railroads, or it was the radical labor movement because they didn't want to work for, 6 days a week for 12 hours a day for pennies an hour, like that. That's what it means to be radical. So, radical environmentalists don't like to see the earth being chewed up. But here, in our own backyard, controversy is heating up over plans by DTE Energy to expand the Fermi 2 nuclear power plant near Monroe. This is a wonderful idea, isn't it? And that intrepid band of Don't Waste Michigan, an anti-nuclear group, and it's co-chaired by Mike Keegan, who has been a guest on this show a number of times, talking about how bad Fermi 1 was. It almost melted down. And in fact, it's there, just kind of radiating, and it's capped. I mean, so it's just
terrible.
Yeah, and Fermi 2, which has had lots of problems.
And I know someone who used to work and inspect those, and he's just like, Julian, It's not good. I don't care what anyone says.
Well, environmental groups want federal officials to deny DTE a license to build and operate this new reactor. But a study of the project conducted by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, found no environmental impact. Huh. Well, you know.
How can that be, you know?
There's nothing happening because you all know what a nuclear power plant like this does, right? Right? You all know what it does? It boils water.
Yeah.
It boils water. And then that creates steam, and then it drives these huge turbines, and then it makes electricity, and then it sends it off to us. But you know, of course, whenever Fermi 2 is down because from one of its many shutdowns, then the whole area blacks out. Oh, no, it doesn't.
That's right.
Nothing happened. So Don't Waste Michigan, along with the Sierra Club of Michigan and three other groups, have been filing complaints against DTE for the plans to build this new nuclear power plant. There hasn't been one built, I think, in 30 years or something like that. So the battle over safety and long-term effects, this is from, I think, the Detroit News today. The battle over safety and long-term effects of nuclear power generation sites has caused controversy across the world. Scrutiny increased after the March 2011 earthquake and subsequent tsunami in Japan, which caused an environmental and health disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi power plant. Yeah, that did sort of bring up a few issues.
Yes.
Right. One of the things that I just ran over in this sentence, and it just is almost a throwaway clause in here, is long-term effects of nuclear power generation. The nuclear, is there anybody who doesn't know that they have this radioactive waste that there is nowhere for it to go? They have no long-term repository. And we're talking about, like 200 years. Oh, I'm sorry, not 200 years, 200,000 years.
Yeah.
This has to be kept. 200,000 years. You know what was happening with human beings 200,000 years ago? Ugga, ugga, boo, ugga, boo, boo, ugga.
What's that? Cavemen?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, your point is the length of time that
200,000 years ago. Yeah, man, that was a long time ago.
This stuff is toxic. They've been trying to put it in pristine areas like Yucca Mountain. Remember that, Peter?
Sure. So where is all this waste that's generated every single day at every single nuclear power plant in the world? Well, let's just talk about in Michigan. On site, right? It's just hanging out there. And this stuff that could poison the entire area. And so what does DTE do? Let's build another. Well, what a great idea.
Oh, what a
Let's see. They've been seeking a license for 4 years, but the company says it's seeking a permit but is not committed to opening another nuclear plant.
Well, okay.
I suppose
they're not committed.
But you know, they actually said in the 1940s when they began the idea of nuclear power generation that they could generate power so inexpensively that it wouldn't be metered.
We wouldn't have to pay a bill?
Or that they would say, okay, it's be $10 a month. You know?
I mean, that's one way to get people to do it.
Yeah. Right. And of course,
I'd rather pay the money.
Yeah. But DTE Energy submitted its 17,000-page application to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in September 2008. Reviewing an application typically takes 5 to 7 years, according to the commission. Now, why in the world would they need a 17,000-page, application? Boy, that's be a bitch to fill out by hand.
Yeah.
Okay. Why do you want this? These things. Current health. All of that.
Email from Jim said, "Hi, Peter and Jalene. He spent 10 years in the submarine service. A good chunk of that was within a few feet of an active nuclear reactor. I don't glow in the dark," he said, and goes on. "Nuclear power is pretty safe." If operated under exact methodology, more bang for the buck and more viable long-term option. Love the show, even though I know we're going to disagree on.
Well, we sort of disagree with that. And at some point, this waste, this unstorable waste, is going to be the crisis.
I mean, really, you have to look at that. That's just a huge part of it, let alone accidents happen. I don't care what anyone says. Dave from Livonia. I didn't reread this, pre-read this. Dig the show, have for years. Oh, an emergency manager for Detroit is going to do one thing that's been sorely needed, he says. Opening Detroit's financial books finally and looking at the mess that needs to be cleaned up. A step toward progress in Dave's eyes.
Hmm. Well, we'll go on with this. Actually, there was a anti-nuclear protest. I love this group. It's a listener to this show and does a lot of good work. The group is called Peace Nick.
Oh, yeah. Hey, everybody.
Named after the man's son who runs it. It's, so it's, you know, they used to call people that were for peace. Peacenicks.
Like
but this
Nicks.
Is peace and then his son's Nick. Name, N-I-C-K.
And, yeah.
So that's cute.
That's a cute one.
So they're out there. And if you Google, I think it might even just be don'twastemichigan.org or something like that. The Department of Energy appointee, thank you, Barack Obama, even though he's talking about alternative energy, his Secretary of Energy, Dr. Ernest Moniz, was pro-nuke and pro-fracking.
Pro-coal.
And coal. And fracking, which you're going to be hearing a lot about in the months and years to come, is where they inject millions of gallons of water that have chemicals treated in it. Along with what's injected. In Michigan, they injected one well with 21 million gallons of water laced with chemicals. And they won't say what chemicals they are. This is poison water tables. And,
right. And when people, you know, the East Coast of... Well, there's a lot of, it's coming to light. A lot of people are protesting. They're getting what it is. People's tap water who live near where fracking occurs is brown. It's toxic.
And sometimes it can be set on fire.
It can be set on fire. That's true. I mean, hello, who wants to, I mean, there's fire water, you know, but who wants to drink that? No one.
And our caller who said it was safe out in Hanford, this area called the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State, their plutonium production for the nation's bomb arsenal is leaking all over the place, right? They have at least six leaks. It's been there since World War II. And even after decades of work and billions of dollars in taxpayer sacrifice, that means in order to store this stuff, which isn't even working, that we've taken billions of dollars. I mean, think about what Detroit, when we're talking about its financial shape, what could be have been diverted into our states and into our cities, into our communities, instead of this
school
madness.
System,
yeah. I like this. In the New York Times, it says, nature might in the end bat last at Hanford in deciding whether the land can ever be healed, but in the meantime, government policy and spending decisions are running the basis. We were mentioning before about, wait a minute. Here, actually, I may have stolen Brian from Clyde's Thunder. Hey, Brian, we were just talking about that. Go ahead. You're on the air about the Washington storage tanks.
Yeah, I heard they were leaking, and first reports I heard, you know, two tanks are leaking, now five tanks are leaking. There's just nowhere to put this stuff.
No, there isn't, because no one, I mean, talk about, and there's some low-level repositories in New Mexico. Actually, some of the, talk about the desperation that some of these Native American tribes that are real poor have
so
agreed
sad.
To store it on their land, their
And
sovereign
think about
nation.
What they're, you know, they're about is about the earth and
yeah.
the trees and
yeah,
oh.
like that.
I say low level, no level. There should be no level.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And I don't think people really conceive of this. In a sense, it's not on the cultural radar, because if you said, I mean, it seems to me that if you had something so dangerous, well, I mean, if you did, we do. This nuclear waste, there's nothing to do with it. I mean, I don't know what. I should try to find out, because I'm certainly somebody from the nuclear power industry. If I said to them, look, there's nowhere to put it, and these things are disastrous, and they're leaking, they wouldn't say, oh, God, I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. There goes my argument. I'm being right.
What are we going to do?
Yeah, they would obviously have some response. That, and I think usually what it is, it's like everybody that is involved in environmental risky stuff, like they these petroleum pipelines that they're talking about. They say now that the technology is such that that there's no risk. Well, there's never been a pipeline ever put in place that hasn't leaked. It hasn't leaked badly. But
we need a wind and sun, you know.
Oh, yeah, solar power, wind energy, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that would create so many good union-paying jobs in Michigan.
There you go.
I just don't understand why we're not shooting for it.
Well, again,
we're shooting for it. The people are shooting for it, but the big industry, the coal industry and all the big bad cats, are, you know, they have so much power in this country. They have so much, you know, in lobbying and Washington going on. And
yeah, and it's what I said. It's sort of what's in the cultural lens. In other words, what seems possible? Well, you can have all, you know, Harvey Wasserman, who's written Solar Utopia, that almost everything could be turned over to solar power. I mean, he's not invited to Congress. No one says, well, I want to hear about your ideas. Companies, I mean, there are
they
solar.
They keep their friends happy. They got to keep those industries going, you know.
There was a full page ad today in the New York Times, or Sunday's New York Times, from the coal industries, from some of the worst ones, Peabody Coal, that's just been destroying New Mexico for the longest time, and a number of other ones. And they were saying that coal now is clean, that there is an increase in coal throughout the world, which is true. But it.
Clean? That's not true.
That's not true. Right. But it must occur to people at some point, you burn stuff, you get stuff in the air you don't want. I mean, isn't that. Who doesn't know that, right?
Yeah, that seems basic, you know. That coal's dirty. There's no way you can scrub it. There's no way you can clean it. And the worst thing about it is, you know, Al Gore was right, and it's just he's such a political figure. Now everybody poo-poos global warming like it doesn't exist. Well, sure it does, you know.
Of course it does. Yeah, so if you ever hear clean coal technology, it's a bunch of BS. Yeah. Don't buy it.
I was going to say oxymoron. BS is a better description. But, you know, Brian, you mentioned how many union jobs that it would create. Unions are mostly on board for things like Keystone because it'd be construction and electricians and everybody, you know, riggers.
And this is the pipeline we're talking about.
Yeah, the pipeline.
Big hot button issue.
So short term, yeah, there's a lot of jobs that would be a boom. But it is such short-sighted, and most of these people that are in the upper echelons of the union movement, and a lot of the rank and file as well. But if you don't have a job, if you're a worker out of that doesn't have a job, you got a family, and someone says, "Hey, you can build this pipeline, and we're going to give you $34.75 an hour and full benefits." Hey, they are there.
Yeah, because it's about here and now, and they're not thinking about the future and the damage that will be done. Inevitably, will be done.
John Miller writes in to us from the other room. I read somewhere that nuclear waste is being recycled into consumer products at microscopic levels to get rid of it. Have you guys heard of this? Well, if it's microscopic, it's tons. So microscopic.
But I'd be curious to find out more about that. Yeah.
There is this. What was the? I can't remember the stuff that when it becomes powder. They were using for armor. Tanks, recycled, Brian, you remember what that is? All of a sudden reconstituted uranium or something. They said they took all of the radioactivity out of it. Did that ring a bell?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. But all
depleted uranium it's called.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Depleted uranium. And, so they say, well, you know, you can put a Geiger counter next to it and you can barely even hear it. All right, well, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Appreciate that. We got to get on our unions, those of us who belong to unions, and say that's not the kind of jobs we want. Because you know, as far as I know, and I could be absolutely wrong,
you just got done saying you're not wrong.
Could be.
Okay.
And this would just be a lack of knowledge.
Okay.
That are there caucuses? You know, they always have caucuses within unions, sometimes like opposition caucuses to the, you know, the current administration of a particular trade union that are organized within all the building trade unions for solar power. You would think they would. And maybe they're doing both. I mean, maybe like the skilled trade union they're saying, okay, we'll build a nuclear power plant you're going to build solar power? Yeah, we'll do, because mostly, well, remember, what was the place in Pennsylvania where there was that nuclear accident in like the 1980s, remember that? Yeah, okay. Wherever it was, and I remember they sent somebody in to do cleanup there, and they had one of those hazmat suits on and all that. And it was the saddest thing that I'd ever heard out of anybody. And they said, aren't you frightened to go in there? And he said, I'm more frightened not to have a job and support my family.
God.
So that is a nuclear Three Mile Island, by the way.
Oh, yes.
That is the worst kind of social and economic blackmail imaginable. Do you want to be unemployed
and
have your family destroyed, or do you want to jeopardize your health?
Yeah, in order maybe to not be
yeah.
there.
Yeah, those are your two choices. Which is it? Yeah. Okay.
Well, Peter,
that's a wrap.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Love to do this. Love to have all of you listening and calling. Appreciate
that. Thank you, John, so much for everything
John
for
doing
us.
It. And
our
one
producer.
One of the things he is going to do is we're going to double his salary.
We are. He's done it. Peter, it, shh.
Okay. Okay. I'll double yours, too.
Thanks.
And I'll double mine. where was I? Facebook.com/nightcall. My website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Today at 6 p.m. in Ann Arbor, you can see Dan Barker, the co-president of Freedom From Religion Foundation, and you can go to their website, ffrf.org.
That's it.
That's it.
The one.
Next week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Ever hear somebody say we can do this the easy way or we can do it the hard way? I mean, what kind of a choice is that? At Geico.com, everything's easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to go paperless by automatically paying your bill online. Easy, easy, easy. So visit Geico.com today. Of course, if you prefer the hard way, I guess you'll have to go someplace else. Sorry, I just don't get it.
The only way 2013 Riff Rock Girl Search is underway. Ladies, get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for being with me. Peter Werbe here. You know, I just read the New York Times today, and here's a big headline. Top earners doubled share of nation's income. The top 1% of earners more than doubled their share of the nation's income over the last three decades. This really wasn't information that was making the headlines in the major media, to be sure. And, in fact, I'm wearing a pin now that says 99%. And that, as many of you may realize, has to do with this series of occupations, including Occupy Detroit, that's ongoing. And the idea is that there's the 99% of us, and then there's the 1% that actually earn all the money and to which power accrues. And this idea isn't particularly new. There's been studies on power and wealth that go pretty far back in American history. And I was thinking of some of the ones that influenced me, and there's a considerable number of them. One of the first ones was done by C. Wright Mills called The Power Elite. It was done in 1956. There's a credible book by William Domhoff called Who Rules America? Another one, The Rich and the Super Rich by Ferdinand Lundberg. Those were done in the 1960s. And then the idea of all of this and who rules America, and most people would say, oh, the people, we have democratic elections. That's who rules it. We know, you know, as Bob Dylan said, money doesn't talk, it swears. But still, we think of this as a democratic country. But this is even more relevant right now, and a book has come my way that really just hits it right at the right time. It's called Oligarchy. And if all of you don't know what that means, we'll get to that as a first definition. It's written by Jeffrey Winters, and he's a professor of political economy at Northwestern University. We're reaching him at his office in Chicago. Jeffrey Winters, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be your guest.
Now, that phrase, and I said maybe a lot of people don't know what it means. 100 years ago, people were much more acquainted with phrases like oligarchy and plutocracy and what have you. Give us an idea of what the oligarchy particularly refers to, the title of your new book.
Sure. Oligarchy refers to being powerful because you have wealth. So there's a lot of ways that people can be powerful throughout history. You might be a warlord and you have armaments, and that makes you powerful. You might hold public office, president, senator, and certainly that makes you vastly more powerful than the average citizen. You might be someone who's able to mobilize many, many hundreds of thousands or millions of people, like Mahatma Gandhi did or like Martin Luther King did. These people have what we call mobilizational power. Well, there's one more category of power, which is wealth. Wealth is a form of power. Not everyone who's wealthy necessarily uses their wealth for political purposes, but a certain number of people do. And so any society like the United States, which has a highly concentrated situation of wealth stratification, empowers some of its citizens vastly more than the average. And so the result is, in a place like the United States, we have both democracy and oligarchy interacting with each other, sometimes peacefully, sometimes at opposite ends. And we're in a moment, as you just said, where in this movement of the 99 versus 1%, this is really the first time, Peter, in maybe 70 or 80 years that the focus in the United States has really been on the problem of the injustices and the disenfranchisement that comes from concentrated wealth and power in a few hands.
Jeffrey Winters, I mentioned that the reform movements of 100 years ago are beginning in the late 19th century and through for quite a few years. Besides oligarchy, the rule of a few with the wealth, that it also plutocracy, and which means, if I remember right, the rule of the rich. What's the difference between the two?
In fact, we have a number of words that refer to largely the same thing.
Okay.
So in fact, plutocrats, oligarchs, they we can just think of them as, for our purposes, as being pretty much synonymous.
Okay.
The key underlying issue there is that we allow in society certain people to be super empowered because they are vastly wealthier than most other citizens, and that the political system is open to the use of wealth for political means.
Well, isn't that, I think most people would take that for granted. I mean, obviously, this country itself was established by some well-meaning men who were all oligarchs, right?
Well, they were all oligarchs, but a couple things can be said. First, they came from a European system where the main thing they were worried about was not just the concentration of wealth and the distortion of the political system because of that, but they were worried about an aristocracy, which was sort of a transgenerational nobility that ran political systems by birth. So the main thing that the founders in the United States sort of sterilized the U.S. system against was aristocracy. So we don't have a nobility, we don't have kings, and so on. What they didn't address, and maybe because some of them were oligarchs themselves, they didn't address the problem that actually the ancient Romans did address, which is the concentrated power of wealth. And what the Romans did that the American founders didn't do is that the Romans set up something called a tribunate of the plebs, where plebs refer to the plebeians. The plebeians are the poor, the ordinary people. And a whole separate institution was set up where membership was exclusively on the basis of being poor. And so to counterbalance the power of the wealthy in the Senate and in other institutions, and everyone accepted that just as you've said, wealth it captures democracy and institutions, it was only by specifically setting up some kind of check and balance based on the wealthy against the poor that any kind of genuine democratic balance was able to come out. And we don't have a tribunate of the plebs in the United States.
Well, aside from the ideologies and theories of, say, socialism and communism and anarchism, the people, I think most people assume that there is going to be a hierarchy of wealth and of power. But there's almost, I don't know, is it a leftover from feudalism that people expect wealth to be administered responsibly? And because, as it was during feudalism, the lords were expected to protect the common people. The common people were supposed to work and provide wealth for the lord. But I think often that the anger would come when the oligarchs didn't perform their social duties. Does that make any sense?
Well, I would look at it slightly differently. I would say this. In the American political system and in its ideologies, we tolerate differences between people. We tolerate inequalities of various kinds. There are people who are better or worse at all kinds of things. There are people who are smarter. There are some people who play the violin better than I do. So we tolerate, we don't expect perfect equality among everyone in our society, but we do expect equal power. The problem is that there's actually no power imbalance that we tolerate as much as the power imbalance that comes with wealth. So if we could, it would be somewhat more ideal if we could separate the two. That is, if we could both say we allow stratification in society. Some people are more ambitious or whatever the case may be, have better opportunities. They get to be more wealthy than the average person. There are things we can do to make sure that there's no easy translation between being wealthy and getting many more, as it were, votes in the political system, a louder voice, being the only people being heard. That is something that I think offends the average American, that just because you're rich, you have the ear of politicians, you're able to shape policies in ways that the rest are not able to do. That's unacceptable. And by the way, it's also, it's not something you could probably ever completely get away from, which is the power of wealth, but it certainly can be dramatically reduced from what it is in the United States. There's steps we can take to make sure that concentrated wealth doesn't have such a loud voice and an overwhelming voice in the American political system.
Well, this is a good point, maybe, to go back a bit in history. My guest in the Peter Werby Show is Jeffrey Winters. He's a professor of political economy at Northwestern University. He's just written Oligarchy, and it's available through Amazon. There'll be a link to it on my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. And let's go back to 1913, because there was the 16th Amendment passed, the 17th Amendment, the Federal Reserve was established, and there are some people, particularly on the political right, that say that's when it all began to go to hell. There's a number, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but there's a number of, videos, let's say, generically videos out on online that say this was the year, you know, that the progressives were able to, you know, distort American democracy and get these two amendments passed and also set up the Federal Reserve. Tell us about 1913 and the importance of these, the elements I just mentioned, if you would, please.
Well, 1913 is actually a replay of 1894. So 1894, with the populist movement and Williams Jennings Bryan and so on, there was a very strong upswell of people at the height of the robber baron era. And what they were reacting to is that however much wealth had been uneven in the United States in the earlier founding years of the country, it was in fact a lot more egalitarian than it became. And by the late 19th century, wealth became vastly, vastly more concentrated, and it became sort of more obviously used in distorting ways. And so in 1894, the very first permanent federal income tax was passed, and it was exclusively on just a fraction of the top 1% of the population. So it was, in a sense, a wealth tax. It was never intended to be an income tax on the rest of the population. That law was immediately overturned by the Supreme Court, and it took 18 years to finally come up with the 16th Amendment, and then in 1913, the federal income tax was once again imposed, and it was only imposed on roughly the top 1% of Americans. So 99% did not pay federal income tax. And that was an expression of the power of movements from below to actually get the wealthiest to pay a larger share of funding a system that was benefiting them tremendously. And that was seen as fair. But the oligarchs didn't like it, and they spent the rest of the 20th century working against the federal income tax that fell on them exclusively. And by the middle, and certainly by the end of the 20th century, the tax burden had been moved downward to the rest of society, and actually it is now regressive. The very, very wealthiest Americans in the United States, and it's a group that would fit roughly in the size of University of Michigan Stadium. That's how many people I'm talking about.
I love that analogy. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so we're talking about a relatively small slice of the population that could watch a football game. They pay, first of all, they make on average per year $350 million. That's just their income on their wealth. And they pay a lower percentage of their overall income in taxes than the average secretary or plumber or worker in the United States does.
Let me just interrupt, because what I always wonder, I mean, that's more money in a year than the entire population of the city I live in makes, probably the whole surrounding area. What do these guys do that they can come up with income of that magnitude? Is this all hedge funds and stuff like that?
Well, a lot of it is hedge funds, but you know, it's also the fact that they're able to keep a larger share of the money that they do make. They're making it globally. They also have a lot of it in offshore havens and in secret companies. So it's a very complex way that they're making this money. But you have to realize also they're making money on their money. This is what we call capital income versus compensation income. So most of us make compensation income. We get a check for work we do. But the very, very wealthiest Americans make money on money. And as we know, with the capital gains tax, that is taxed at only 15%. And it's not a surprise that the the very, very powerful people at the top who make money on money were able to win a victory of not having their income from their wealth be taxed in the same way that my tax rate on my compensation is taxed, which is I'm in a higher tax bracket, just as an ordinary professor at a university, than the very wealthiest Americans are. And this means that they have exceedingly low tax rates. Let me give you a very interesting number.
Sure.
About the concentration of wealth, just so people realize. If we compare the United States today with Imperial Rome, and Imperial Rome was a system that was run by, you know, roughly 500 to 1,000 senators at the top, and it was essentially a slave and farmer society. The gap between the very wealthiest at the top in Rome and the average citizen down below was about 10,000 to 1 in terms of wealth. In the United States today, it is 20,000 to 1. So we have twice the wealth concentration at the top, and I'm comparing roughly the top 1,000 Americans or so to the average person of the bottom 90%.
That's extraordinary. And you know, I also do a phone-in talk show, and sometimes I'll get these angry guys, usually working-class men, that say their voice is almost trembling, and they'll say, it's their money, they made it, who are you to try to take it away from them? Because they see where, or they suspect where you're going, Jeffrey Winters, is that there ought to be greater wealth and income equality, there ought to be higher taxes on the wealthy, and the idea that that the government is trying to take away these people's money really offends them almost on an ethical basis. What do you say to that?
Well, I think, first of all, one of the things that a person like that is imagining is that someday that might be them, right? So they're thinking, well, I might be very wealthy someday, and I certainly wouldn't want a government taxing me and possibly redistributing through programs on education, health, and so on that other people in society might get taken care of. So I think that sentiment is a combination of two things. One, it's a kind of vicious selfishness, but it's also just a misreading of the individual's own class position and where they're ever going to end up in their lives. And I think the Horatio Alger stories in the United States and a lot of propaganda that comes out of think tanks in the United States has done a good job of getting a number of Americans like the ones you're talking about to identify with and even defend the super wealthy. It's against their interests to do so. It's against the interests of their children and the future of their children to do so. I'm not talking about taking away all the money and having an absolutely egalitarian society in the United States. I think that's utopian. Doesn't make any sense. But I do think that we can do a lot to ask of the people at the very top, which we've always done in the progressive tradition of the United States. We've always had the view that those who have vastly more take on more responsibility for bearing the cost of our whole community so that our entire community is healthy. There are people at the bottom who are vastly less able to pay. They're struggling. They're working hard, and they're not necessarily making it. And so progressivity in our tax system has been a long tradition, and I think it's important that we keep it. We currently don't have it.
I wonder why they even want to keep so much money. In fact, I want to get to your thoughts about what you call the income defense industry, and maybe I'll lead into that by talking about this. Warren Buffett once said that if it took away 99% of my wealth, it would not change my standard of living one bit. So when you talk about somebody having $50 billion or poorer guys like the mayor of New York having 10 or 11 billion, you could confiscate 98% of their wealth. They'd still have tens of millions of dollars left. They would still be probably still in the top 1%. Why do they want all this money? And what form is it? I mean, when you talk about Bill Gates being worth $50 billion, I mean, if someone said, Bill, we want you to bring all your money tomorrow and put it on the table, I mean, he couldn't do it, right? I mean, it's not there. I mean, I wonder if there's even any really there.
Well, a lot of it is you've hit on a number of really important things. First of all, the form of wealth has changed dramatically over history. So, for example, in medieval Europe, if I was incredibly wealthy, I would almost for sure hold my wealth in the form of land and agriculture. And I would control a lot of peasant farmers under me, but I would also have to spend a huge amount of my wealth to defend my land and my realm directly. So I would have to build castles, I would have to build moats, I would have to raise knights and militias, and I would have a lot of threats coming horizontally from other lords and other knights in the system. Today, for Warren Buffett or for Bill Gates, if they have $20 billion one year, and then the next year they somehow are able to increase that to $40 billion, they don't, and here's the remarkable thing about the United States today, they don't have to spend one penny in increased defenses for their wealth. They simply, the numbers change, but unlike in the past where you had to have expenditures to defend your wealth, it turns out that we all jointly defend the wealth, and we do it through our army, through our police force. We all pay for it jointly, and this is a remarkable period in history where the money is held electronically and digitally in banks. It's held in the form of stocks. And therefore, by the way, it is very vulnerable to the health and well-being of the system itself. They may have some in the form of gold, jewels, and so on, but a lot of their wealth is literally on paper. And if that paper, whether it's currency or stock shares or banks, if it becomes worthless, the money disappears very quickly. That's different from wealth in land, wealth in cattle, and so on.
You know, this discussion is so important and to all of our well-being that I'm letting the time get away from me. I said I wanted to, I was reading an article you wrote called America's Income Defense Industry that was on Huffington Post in 2010, but I think we really should move into, and because we have only about 3 or 4 minutes left with Jeffrey Winters, the author of Oligarchy, brand new book, get it. You can find out what we're all facing when people are talking about 99%. It's all right in there. But anyway, you talk about in your article about that the income defense industry, which lobbyists and lawyers, which helped the wealthiest Americans avoid paying nearly $70 billion in taxes. Everyone's talking about fixing the tax code, that it shouldn't be millions and millions of words. We got, you know, simplistic ones from a couple of the Republican candidates. The president has talked about making alterations. What should we be doing? I mean, should we just, people are saying tax the rich. That's one of the signs. I mean, what some of the signs say eat the rich, but we're not going to go there. We're going to talk about the people that say tax the rich. Is that a good thing to do? And will it help the country? Will it help the economy?
It absolutely will help. We are running deficits, and the wealthy are able to pay, and there's no correlation in history between how much we tax the very wealthy and whether jobs get created. It's just a specious argument. Jobs were being created in the 50s and 60s at a very, very high rate, and the tax rate on the top bracket was 70%, which is twice what it is today. So the taxes that those at the very, very top who are able to pay them have to pay have nothing to do with job creation. It's just a lie. The income defense industry arose in the 60s and 70s. It is armies and armies of professionals, lawyers, accountants, lobbyists, whose sole function, the entire industry arises for one purpose only, to make sure that the very wealthiest Americans can first of all lower their tax brackets overall and then pay as low a percentage of their tax bracket as they possibly can. And that income defense industry, roughly right now, reduces the taxes for the very wealthy from the 35% bracket down to about 16% on average that they're paying. And so it's a very effective industry. And it takes advantage of the 71,684 pages of tax code. I actually am very in favor of simplifying our tax system, but I'm not in favor of the very wealthiest and the very poorest paying the same rate. I think what we can do is we can have a graduated system of brackets where everybody in their bracket simply pays the full rate in their bracket with no deductions, and we can have that from 0% for the very poorest down at the bottom all the way up to 70% for the very highest at the top. Simple way to do it, but a graduated system.
Now, they just did a poll. In fact, it was in the New York Times today as well, where they said that, I should have printed out, but it was something like almost 70% of people polled said that they felt the Republicans had the interests of the rich primarily as their focus. And interestingly, about 30 or 40% thought the same of the Democrats, but they're probably both correct. But you say also in your article that Obama's bark is worse than his bite. Now, many of us expect the Democratic Party is going to defend the interests of the middle class and the working class and the poor. But if all we've got is a bark from them, we can't expect too much. So we have mass-based movement. That's often been the basis of change throughout American history. Is there any political will other than in the streets to actually take a bite out of this inequality?
Well, I like to joke with my students sometimes that my definition of the Republican Party is organized selfishness, and the definition of the Democratic Party is organized selfishness with guilt.
That's good.
And, and it's not such a huge difference between the two. Both parties are bought and paid for by the same small number of people at the top, the one half of 1% called the donor class. The myth of Obama is actually that he came to power on the basis of millions and millions of small donations. In fact, the small donations and the grassroots movement for Obama launched him at the beginning, but once he became a major contender against Hillary Clinton in the primaries, huge money came in from Wall Street and bundlers and everyone else. And Obama accepted that money. And when he was inaugurated, he paid back those forces by putting basically Wall Street representatives into his cabinet. And that's why we've seen policies which have not been responding to the people at the bottom and have been responding to Wall Street. In fact, Obama has been nothing but worried from the get-go about whether business likes him or not.
Hmm.
And what he really needs to understand is that he's going to be a one-termer if he doesn't win back the enthusiasm of the people down below that got him there in the first place, at least in terms of their votes, not in terms of their money.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on my show, Professor Jeffrey Winters. He's teaches political economy at Northwestern University. We're talking to him in Chicago. He has a brand new book out called Oligarchy. That's the 1%, folks, published by Cambridge University Press. It's available through Amazon. I'll have a direct link to it on my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Thank you so much for being on the broadcast.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and Mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
WRIF is hosting an exclusive College Hoops bracket party, and you can win a spot on the guest list. We're taking over Village Ford on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn on March 20th. We've created the ultimate game for guests to get their custom WRIF mini basketball that will win their spot onto Village Ford's basketball bracket, and the listener with the winning college team at the end of the tournament will win a $500 Visa gift card. It's a WRIF party, so guests will be treated to food, prizes, and rockin' games. Go to WRIF.com and enter to win your spot on the VIP guest list to party and win with WRIF and Village Ford.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werbe here with you. I want to introduce my guest by way of the title of her book. It's called The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. And there's a lot of loaded words in there, ones that we hear frequently but have different interpretations of them. Revolution is one. When we think about the American Revolution, that's the phrase in the title, The Next American Revolution, that's good. sometimes when we think of other revolutions, for instance, most Americans, when they hear about the Russian Revolution or the Chinese Revolution, they think that's bad. When you hear the word a revolution in hairstyling, we know it's an absolutely meaningless phrase. And also, the subtitle of the next American Revolution is Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. And activism is another one of those words that has a lot of meaning to it. Most of us aren't very active in the political life of our society. We may, although sometimes not very many of us go out to vote, but very few of us are involved in the old-fashioned face-to-face democracy that really can generate a healthy society. Well, let me bring our guest to the microphone. She's Grace Lee Boggs, and she's written The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century, along with Scott Kurashige. And it has a foreword by the actor Danny Glover. And Grace Lee Boggs is the recipient of many human rights and lifetime achievement awards. She's an activist, a writer, and a speaker. She's celebrated in the National Women's Hall of Fame. She's co-author with her late husband, James Boggs, of Revolution and Evolution in the 20th Century, and the author of Living for Change, an autobiography. She's the daughter of Chinese immigrants. She's 95 years old. She lives in the city of Detroit and is active in a center named after her and her husband. It's the Boggs Center. You can go to theboggscenter.org. She's also an old friend of mine, Grace Lee Boggs. Welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Oh, hello, Peter. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for being on the program. Let's start off with maybe the most difficult, the next American Revolution. I mean, that sometimes can scare people. What we think of violence, we think of what's going on, say, in the Middle East and all that. When you, Grace Lee Boggs, think about the next American Revolution, what do you have in mind?
Well, I think the words extremely important. Next American and revolution. Let's start with the revolution. Most people do not recognize that the concept of revolution itself is a changing concept. That long ago, before the revolution, say, in England in the 17th century and in France in the 18th century, and people thought of revolution mostly in cyclical terms. It was a physical thing about, say, you'd say, almost like rotation. And then when the Russian Revolution took place in 1917, people began to associate revolution with the seizure of state power. And we've seen what's happened to that revolution, so people are not very friendly towards the concept of revolution. They see that in Russia, for example, the people who take over state power become a prisoner of the state. And if it's a czarist state, the Bolshevik state which takes over has much the same structure, has much the same behavior and conduct. So we have to think in terms of revolution and ask ourselves, what does revolution mean to us in the 21st century? And I think that what does it mean to us as Americans? On the American aspect, let me say this. I think what's very important for us to understand is that in the American Revolution was unique among revolutions because what the phrase, the power within us to create the world anew, I think is most closely associated with the American Revolution. So people love the idea of revolution. They love the idea of embracing the power within us to create the world anew. It's very inspiring. But they don't want to understand what contradictions were also built in the American Revolution, that it took place on a very on a continent that was relatively underpopulated. It took place at a time when economic growth was emphasized. And so one of the first things we began to do was to take the land away from the Native Americans and enslave workers so that we could achieve rapid economic growth. And so that contradiction was built into the American Revolution, and the whole concept of building the world anew became flawed. So when we come to the next American Revolution, what we want to do is to embrace the concept of creating the world anew, but we also want to face the fact that in the course of creating the first American Revolution and over the period since that time, we have achieved economic growth at the at enormous expense, at the expense of degrading other peoples, at the expense of exploiting the resources of the earth, at the expense of the earth, and at the expense of our humanity. So there's a lot to be done in thinking about the second American Revolution or the next American Revolution. It means that many of the contradictions that were created in the course of our achieving economic growth have now got to be faced. So well, that means that the next American Revolution, instead of being like other American revolutions, which were made to achieve greater income and for the masses, we have to give up things. We are at a point where to expand our humanity and to really create the world anew, we have to begin thinking about how do we advance our human evolution.
Most people think of revolutions of increasing political liberty and or having a better material basis for their lives. I mean, that certainly was one of the motivations in some of the third world countries, in China and Russia and what have you. But isn't it a hard sell when you have to tell people that actually we might have to have less of a material life? I know you're saying we would expand our humanity. We have a world now based around commodity production and consumption, but that means a lot to people, and they often associate that with material success and material security. Expand, if you would, a little on what it would mean to have a revolution of which we had less material benefits.
Well, the first chapter of the new book is called These Are the Times to Grow Our Souls. And the idea that growing our souls could be the goal of our next American Revolution may seem strange on first hearing, but if we recognize how much we have lost of our humanity in the achievement and the pursuit of rapid economic growth, it would not seem so alien a phrase.
Mm-hmm. And let me reintroduce you as well. My guest is Grace Lee Boggs, a Detroiter who has contributed so much to a sense and a possibility of renewal in our city. And her latest book is called The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. The state apparatus, as we see, whether it's Egypt or certainly in Libya, and as we saw even in the American Revolution, the ruling state apparatus is what keeps the status quo. Can we have a revolution that doesn't attack the political state?
Well, I think that how we deal with the question of the political revolution is secondary to how we deal with the question of the evolution of our humanity. I don't know exactly what will be the scenario for the political revolution. It may take a different form. Let's say, for example, that in the course of developing the things that make our lives more human, we have to face a counter-revolution. That might lead to a different kind of political struggle. And I don't know what that will be. I don't know, and you don't know, and nobody knows, in fact. But I think we have to keep in mind words like possibility that you just used, and that we try to achieve, we see our revolution not so much as advancing our material successes, but as changing our values and our relationships with one another.
You know, I recently interviewed, all of a sudden, his name is right out of my mind, too, a cartoonist, and he was calling for a violent revolution. I thought, whoa, what? In fact, he did it in the last minute of the conversation that I have. And Grace Lee Boggs, when you talk about the next American Revolution, you're not calling for an armed revolution.
No, I think the idea of that the identification of revolution with violence and with arming is something that people thought of, you know, in the past a great deal, and not only in other countries, but in this country as well, because much of the movements that started out originally for power, for example, thought in terms of like the Black Panther Party of armed struggle. But I think we have learned a lot about how, as Gandhi said, that we have to be the change that we want to see in the world.
Now, you wrote this book along with Scott Kurashige, and it has a foreword by Danny Glover. It's published by the University of California. And this was all written before the events in Madison, before the demonstrations in our own state capital of Lansing, before the Middle East uprisings and change of regimes and what have you. And on the cover of your book, there's this wonderful photograph of you with your characteristic broad smile. And you've been an activist for 7 decades, and you always have this hope. But and probably today you could say, wow, people are fighting back against authoritarian rule all over the world. But when this was put together, none of those events had happened. And I know you have hope. What fills your heart with hope?
Well, I think if you look at what's taking place across North Africa, for example, it's very exciting that all the problems of reconstructing society, which we've been forced to do here in Detroit, and to begin to create new relationships with one another, and to bring the neighbor back into the hood, for example, all those problems they still face. All they've done is get rid of an authoritarian dictator, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very exciting. But all the problems of rebuilding society and re-spiriting society still face them.
Yeah. Well, let me just ask you a little about yourself. Your personal history goes way back into the formal left of the 1940s, and you were part of these sort of traditional political parties that had the idea of a left political party, a command or cadre party would lead the masses to revolution, and you shed all that. And what happened in your thinking to make you think that, like, a model like Russia or China or Cuba, let's leave Cuba out of it. Russia and China led by a radical or communist or socialist party was not the way to bring about revolution. What happened in your own personal political development?
Well, I always say that how you develop politically depends a lot on when you become radical. I was very fortunate that I became a radical in the early part of the 1940s. And that at that time, the black movement was just beginning. In fact, what actually inspired me to become a radical was the March on Washington movement that was led by A. Philip Randolph, which was demanding jobs for blacks in the plants. And the idea of the black movement and the struggle which blacks have been carrying on for so many years, which has not only been for particular things like desegregation or for the right to vote, but for more human relationships in our country and in our society. And I think I was very lucky that I became a radical at that time and was motivated by that search for more human relationships.
Mm-hmm. And as I said at the beginning of the program, you're an American-born Chinese, and you married an African-American man, James Boggs, who was an incredible thinker and has written his book, Revolution and Evolution in the 20th Century, is amazing book, still relevant. How did that relationship affect your thinking?
Well, I think it's affected my thinking incalculably. In fact, I think that if you, I don't know, have you seen the James Boggs Reader, by the way? It's just been issued by Wayne State University Press. It's a huge book, and it deals with four periods of Jimmy's life. And I still really get a great deal out of it. It was affected me enormously to be married to a black man living here on the east side of Detroit. And someone who was working in the plant and who was a very thoughtful person, and who, as he watched the high tech taking place over in the plant and the shrinking of the workforce.
This is as early as the early 1960s.
Even earlier than that, because Jimmy went into the Chrysler plant at the beginning of World War II. And then at the end of World War II, he watched how automation from the war was brought into the plant, and machines began to replace workers. And it gave him a whole new view of what a revolution has to accomplish. Before that, the idea, the radicals had associated the revolution with the expanding workforce and had thought of it mostly in technological terms and in economic terms. That was how Marxism, conceived the revolution. And this gave Jimmy, in his first book, The American Revolution, Pages from a Legal Worker's Notebook, it gave him a new concept of revolution as involving our participation in doing something besides a job. He began to understand that the concept of democracy and expanding democracy, for example, and the constant development of democracy beyond electoral democracy to participatory democracy, which means expansion of the human being. He began to interpret revolution in those terms and began to understand also that as the American empire dies, we would be faced with all these very profound questions. And I think that has helped me enormously during the last 60, 70 years.
And a lot of this is reflected in your book, The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. Grace Lee Boggs is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. It's published by the University of California Press. And a lot of these ideas that Grace Lee Boggs is telling us is manifest in the Boggs Center. And you go to Boggs, B-O-G-G-S, center.org. There'll be a link on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And I said earlier about the optimism that you always exhibit. And the Boggs Center, still on the east side of Detroit, and where so many people have given up on Detroit, a quarter of the population lost in the last 10 years, yet you remain hopeful about our city that we all say, even if we don't live in Detroit, we say our city. What's going on in Detroit that has the opposite effect from what makes people leave? What makes people stay? What makes you stay?
Well, my first year of graduate school, I was introduced to Hegel, the German philosopher, who derived his ideas out of the French Revolution. And he was a very young man at the fall of the Bastille and was very hopeful. But by the time he was a grown man, Napoleon had come on the scene, and he could see that the French Revolution had been born of hope and had created a lot of contradictions. And out of that, he developed the philosophy that progress does not take place in a straight line, or as he said, like a shot out of a pistol, but it takes the labor, patience, and suffering of the negative. And that gave me a way of thinking that you can look at what is happening as in front of your eyes, say, like the abandonment here in Detroit, only as a negative. Or you can see it as something that is a challenge to you to see a positive. And so I found that has been reflected in life, that whereas most people looked at the vacant lots that emerged out of deindustrialization, deindustrialization as only negative, there were African-American people who had been raised in the South who saw the vacant lots as an opportunity to grow food for the community and also to help urban kids who have a concept of change only like a push button concept of change to develop a more patient understanding of process.
Well, you know, you were a speaker, one of several, at a forum maybe last year or maybe even the year before that was put on by The Nation magazine. And everyone else, including some very prominent people, Barbara Ehrenreich and Susan Watson from, or not, actually I'm forgetting her first name, Joan Watson from the Detroit City Council, were all talking about when our jobs come back, when our unions come back to the city of Detroit. And you were sort of the sole voice that said, I wouldn't count on all that. And if I'm correct, I think you distinguish between jobs and work. Am I correct in that?
Thank you for asking that, Peter. I think that's one of the most important distinctions we can make. You know, people think that jobs have lasted forever, and yet jobs and working for pay is only a very recent development for the last 300 years, perhaps. Before that, people worked in order to produce goods and services, but they didn't think in terms of being paid for it. They worked to develop skills, to develop community, and we are at that beautiful point of transition to thinking of working not only to produce goods and services, but as a way for us to create community. Instead of becoming so individual and becoming preoccupied with our own incomes, which has resulted in such disaster both to the earth and to our human relationships.
And you are hopeful. You do see a seed of this in the many things that are present in Detroit. One of the things is I think that people don't see. I'm on this list. I'm only seeing the initials in my mind. I'm actually overwhelmed by the amount, and this is good, overwhelmed by the amount of email that comes announcing the positive things that are going on in the city of Detroit. Everything from urban agriculture and big community feasts and 20, 30 other things that are happening all around. But most of this is invisible because I think that people spend so much time just glued to the television and that filters through the corporate media. So I think they're missing a lot of this. And at the beginning I was talking about face-to-face, and I think you would agree that's what we have to bring back. Huh?
Yes. You know, Peter, it's sort of how you see things. The idea that vision is neutral is ridiculous. If you see things through a materialistic point of view and you think that having a lot of jobs and having a lot of money is the purpose of life, that's one thing. If you see things more with your heart and think that being relating to other people and feeling that other people are your what matters, and you see different things.
You do indeed. And I guess I just want to finish by saying if any of these ideas are new to you, and I suspect they are, because this isn't the way we've been taught to look at the world. It's always been about material advancement. We've heard so much about this coming generation is not going to do as well as the generation before them, and people are concerned about it. There's different avenues and different ways that history unfolds. I think that's one of the things you were saying. This is a great book to pick up as an introduction to alternative ideas. It's The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. It was written with Scott Kurashige from the University of Michigan, and we didn't even get to the wonderful introduction by actor Danny Glover, who is on the Boag Center Board of Directors. Am I correct?
No, he isn't actually. He's a very good friend, but not on the Board of Directors.
Okay.
Let me say one word
sure.
more about the book.
Yeah.
It's kind of a promo. To my surprise, even though the book has only been out for a couple of months, it is now being ranked by Amazon, along with political books by authors like Noam Chomsky and Paul Krugman. Can you imagine that?
You know what? I can. I think people are ready for new ideas. The old ones have run out of steam, and some people want to go back to some imaginary era that really never even existed, and other people that have the courage to think new thoughts can do well by picking up this book. It's published by the University of California, The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century. My guest has been its author, Grace Lee Boggs. Grace, as usual. Oh, I should say, and you can go to boggscenter.org. It's B-O-G-G-S center.org. Be a link on my site, as always, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Grace, wonderful talking with you.
Good to talk to you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIN. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
This is it.
Fine, let's do it. I'm ready. Go.
Everything that rocks.
Just like
You're so very special.